Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
And The Lyric Stage, presenting The Drowsy Chaperone. This bubbly love letter to musical theater includes mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. Now through May 12th at Lyric Stage Boston. Tickets at lyricstage.com.
I'm Jim Browdy, ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. The Alex Murdoch trial was plastered over cable news, and the murders have been the subject of podcasts, even two documentaries. A jury found him guilty of murdering his wife and son after just 3 hours of deliberations. We'll open the lines to get your thoughts on both the verdict and the lightning speed with which the jury reached it. Then Boston's neighborhoods are recovering from the pandemic faster than downtown. Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung joins us to talk about why and what more Mayor Wu can do to boost downtown activity.
I'm Marjorie Egan. The Bay State Banner, Boston's oldest black-owned newspaper, has been in the Miller family for decades. Now it's changing hands to a local investment group that's also black-owned. GBH's Kelly Crossey joins us to discuss this and Fox News beside themselves over Disney's new so-called woke Peter Pan. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Well, it's okay. I'm very well, thank you. I want to mention that we are live at the Boston Public Library.
We are.
We are streaming on youtube.com/GBHnews
yep.
And facebook.com/GBHnews.
Excellent presentation.
Thank you very much.
So yesterday, as you all know, a jury found South Carolina lawyer Alex Murdoch guilty of the murder of his wife and son. Here's the moment this morning that Judge Clifton Newman sentenced Mr. Murdoch.
All right, Mr. Murdoch, I sentence you to the State Department of Corrections on each of the murder indictments in the murder of your wife, Maggie Murdoch. I sentence you for the term of the rest of your natural life for the murder of Paul Murdoch, whom you probably love so much. I sentence you to prison for murdering him for the rest of your natural life. Those sentences will run consecutive.
And during that sentencing, by the way, Murdoch was just looking at the judge, no expression, no emotion. Marjorie and I have been following this case. Much of America has been following this case. Now that it's over, we're opening the phone and text lines at 877-301-8970. How are you reacting to the verdict and sentence? And there's one other thing. New York Times columnist Farhad Maju raised concerns about the lightning deliberation time, 3 hours using mostly digital records as evidence. I am totally with him, not only in that regard, but he and I both agree, and I'm sure most of America agrees, that Murdoch was likely guilty. But no witnesses, no weapons, no forensic evidence, no blood-soaked clothing. The DNA was useless, because obviously his DNA would be found on something of his wife and son. Yet the jury decided it only needed 3 hours to reach a conclusion, which led to the judge this morning sentencing Murdoch to life in prison. We want to get your reaction to this whole trial. 877-301-8970 for phone or text.
You know, there were a few fascinating moments when the judge was addressing Murdoch this morning when he was talking about how the family had been so prominent in South Carolina for all these years, where his late grandfather's picture had once hung in the courtroom where Murdoch was tried. They took it down for this particular trial. But it's just kind of a incredible tale about someone spiraling downward. An opioid addiction that caused him, he claimed, to be paranoid and lie. But and I'm sure that part is probably true, but it's just a story of someone's complete and total downfall.
You know, the conventional wisdom, and this is not only from my limited experience as a lawyer centuries ago, but also observing, reading about lots of trials. I think you'd agree with this. When a jury comes back in lightning fast time, like this jury does, the overwhelming perception is that it's a not guilty verdict.
Right.
In a murder trial, they're not going to say guilty on all counts.
OJ, four hours.
Exactly, not guilty. So that made this even. Are you concerned at all about the jury deliberation 3 hours. I don't want to repeat this. No witnesses, no weapons, no forensic evidence, no blood-soaked clothing, and the DNA that was found was totally useless, yet they only had a lot of complex data in this case that was relied upon. And in 3 hours, 12 jurors decided that he should be found guilty of murder?
First of all, I suspect we're going to hear from these jurors the next couple of days to get their explanation about why it was so fast so we can find that out. But second of all, I mean, you're a lawyer. I was a reporter. Covered a lot of trials, and I learned very early on that if you're not in the courtroom and you don't hear the evidence and you don't watch the body language and how someone he took the stand, very unusual for the murderer to take, or the alleged murderer, well, I guess
he's
we can call
murderer
him
now.
A murderer now to take the stand, very unusual. His lawyers didn't want him to do it. I think he thought, because he lied his way through so many instances in his life and gotten away with it for so long, that he was going to be able to lie his way through his testimony. And it's clear to me that the problem for this guy is that he got up there in pretty remarkable a lot of circumstantial evidence, even though, as you say, there was no weapon and no bloody clothing. You get up there, and they didn't believe a word out of this guy's mouth.
Well,
he had no credibility, and I think that's why they were able to they didn't have to go to all the digital, you know, records of who called when, how many calls went through, and all the rest of that stuff.
Almost the whole case was based on data and digital records. I mean, it was.
But again, I think a jury can look at someone, look at their body language, look at their voice, look at the way they talk, look at the way they backtrack.
Do you know how many
things.
Witnesses there were in this case?
70
witnesses.
That's right.
70 witnesses. And so what did they consider? I mean, I want to be clear so that people
aren't. I think he cooked.
I want to be clear. My position is I watch a lot of this trial at night. I am convinced this guy is guilty as an observer, as a television watcher, as a reader, not as a juror. However, I say 70 witnesses and all of the absence of all these things I've repeated a couple of times, 3 hours to me is not enough. That's as long as our radio show, Marjorie. From now until whatever it is, 2 hours and 49 minutes, that's how long it took for this jury to decide that a guy should, well, they didn't sentence him, but a verdict that led to his life sentence. By the way, the pivotal moment in terms of what Marjorie's talking about lying, he takes the stand, the husband, the father, admitting that he lied to investigators when he told him he hadn't been to the estate's dog kennels on the evening of the killings, only coming clean when he took the stand. Here's a back and forth about that between the prosecutor and Murdo himself.
So we can agree that the prosecution and law enforcement and so many of your friends and family heard for the first time your story about the kennels yesterday after all these weeks of testimony. Can we agree on that?
That law enforcement, my partners, and my friends heard me say that for the first time. Yes, I agree with that.
Okay, and again, we want to get your reaction to the whole situation because it consumed a lot of attention for people all across the country. But I'm particularly interested in as to whether or not you're concerned about how the jury processed the information. Let me give you one example, Marjorie, before we did the calls, from this Manjou's column in the Globe talking about, in the Times, talking about data that was confusing. One of the things the prosecutors relied upon is that when Murdaugh, the murderer, drove to his mother's house, it was at 70 miles an hour.
Right.
And they said, well, obviously he's driving that fast, the prosecutors, to get away from the scene of the crime. Do you know how fast he drove back to the scene of the crime?
80.
80 miles an hour.
he had a heavy foot, I think. Well, we don't know why he had a heavy foot.
But I'm serious here. So on that, let's talk about that one issue for a second.
Yep.
And there were zillions of those kinds of issues. 3 hours. How long would it take 12 people, all of whom are, I assume, pretty engaged in the issue, to discuss that one fact? A half hour? 45 minutes?
Well, you know, lots of times a jury will go right around the room when they get in there for the first 15
That's exactly
minutes
right.
and say, how do you feel? And
that cause you a problem?
No, it doesn't mean they're going to end things right that moment. I presume, I don't know, because we haven't heard from the jurors yet, but
that.
They may have done that, and they may have gone through these different issues of the case. Listen, you know, I wasn't in the courtroom. I didn't see him. But all this digital stuff, all the data, all the details about cell phones and stuff, apparently it did not override
obviously
what this
not.
Jury saw from this guy when he took the stand. And the guy has been lying and lying and lying.
Okay, can I put it one other
his
way?
His whole life about everything.
Okay, let me put it one other way, and then we'll get to the Coles.
He faked this having somebody kill him, right? Before.
Yeah, just so can I get, let me explain better just mm-hmm. one thing, and then we'll get to the Coles. I'm on this jury in there, and we do the initial roundabout, and everybody says, I think the guy's guilty. Mm-hmm. And you know what I say in that jury? I am one of 12 who believe he's guilty. But in light of the fact he's probably going to get life in prison without the possibility of parole, or at least life in prison, fellow jurors, I think we have an obligation to look at each of the major pieces of evidence and probably reach the same conclusion at the end. But after 70 witnesses and all these other problems with the testimony or the absence of testimony or evidence, we owe it to the state and to justice to spend that amount of time. I'm stunned that you don't think that this is an not the conclusion, but the timing that led to the conclusion doesn't trouble you at all. But apparently it doesn't.
Well,
my guess doesn't.
You're Susan from Cranston. I believe the brief deliberation might result from people, jurors, actually paying attention during the trial. And, you know, it's not a bad theory that they were really paying attention during the trial. And the coup de grace is when you get up there against his lawyer's advice, took the stand.
I guess you're right.
And they didn't believe a word out of the guy's mouth.
Lee in Westboro, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome. Hi.
Hi. So glad you took my call. I call quite often.
Good.
I agree with you, Jim. I feel like he was guilty, but I was very concerned to read in the New York Times today, for the first time, there was unidentified DNA under his wife's fingernails. And that's the first time I saw mention of that.
Yeah, I didn't see the mention.
Yeah,
of it
that was mentioned during the trial.
It was in the Times today.
Yeah, yes. that was mentioned during the trial. Lee.
Well, why don't you address that, Marjorie? Did that deserve some consideration by the jury?
Well, the
well,
jury.
Also, the police should have done their best to figure out whose it was.
Well, I would assume, with due deference to the cops, they may have tried.
Well,
but at least it's an issue that they should have explored.
There was
a
lot of, I don't know whether they explored it or not, but Lee, there was a lot of criticism of the police investigation, saying that they decided that Alex Murdaugh was the killer from the moment this began, and that they may have not done a thorough investigation. There's a lot of murder trials where the cops are criticized for not doing a thorough investigation.
But Lee, thank you for that call, Lee. That was great. Again, I'm going to try to make the point one more time. Do you think the jury had an obligation within those 3 hours to take a second look at every potentially exculpatory piece of evidence in this trial, including what Lee just mentioned? Do you think they have an obligation to do that, or they can just conclude we think he's a liar, so guilty as charged, prison for life?
Well, we have a text from Paul from Somerville. If he's correct,
he
says he already heard from one of the jurors this morning on some TV show, and they said they made up their mind in 45 minutes.
Can you check that, Jamie, to see if that's true? Thank you for the text. Let's go to Paul in New York. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Hey, long-time listener. Called a few times.
Good.
I don't know if he's guilty or not, but just doesn't make any sense that he would switch guns in the middle of fucking killing somebody.
Switch guns in the middle of killing somebody? What do you mean?
Well, he started to kill the son with a shotgun and killed his wife with an assault rifle.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know about that, Paul.
They didn't explain that or anything. You know what I mean? It's
We'll check. That's not a fact that either of us are familiar with. We'll check on that. Our colleagues will, too. Paul, thanks for the call. 877-301-8970.
Here's Barbara from Hopkinton. I think justice was served. I love the fact that it was a black justice who oversaw the case and sentenced him. That's from Barbara in Hopkinton. And, you know, it wasn't, I mean, the whole speech from the judge was kind of unusual at the beginning, but he did talk about how Murdaugh had been before him in his courtroom and other cases, and that people had been sentenced to death for far fewer heinous crimes. And, of course, the prosecution did not ask for the death penalty. They asked for life in prison.
You know, one of the other things, while the judge commented on the fact that that while Murdaugh had a right not to make any statement before sentencing, he found it interesting that he chose not to. You know what I've never seen before in a sentencing? The judge asked Murdaugh a question. Do you remember what that was about, Marjorie? Because you're not paying attention.
No, I was reading reading the text messages.
Okay, Lee in Boxborough, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Lee.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I lived in that area of South Carolina for 20-some years.
Oh.
And knew of the family, didn't know them. I'm surprised that, well, let me just say, I would not be surprised if someone had in the family had gotten to the jury, because that family had their fingers in everybody's pockets in law enforcement in that part of the state. And maybe the fact that they came to a conclusion so quickly was due to the fact that somebody like the family of the girl that Paul killed on the boat accident got to the jury and caused the verdict that came through. I don't know. It could have gone either way. But
well, but keep in mind, getting to a juror, it's one thing when one juror holds out. In this situation,
right.
All 12 of them said guilty as charged, and as Marjorie just read a text a minute ago, there was a suggestion that they had reached a conclusion in 45 minutes. Actually, we have this. Thank you. And Lee, thanks for the call. Jamie, check this out. A juror who voted to convict Myrtle on Thursday told ABC News the jury made their decision in 45 minutes. 9 jurors, including the one who talked to ABC, believed the defendant was guilty. 2 thought he was innocent, and 1 were unsure. So how did they make a decision in 45 minutes if 2 thought he was innocent? By the way, if this is true, Marjorie, does this make my point better? In 45 minutes, at least the second half of this suggests, Jamie, if this is right, in that vote after 45 minutes, 2 of them thought he was innocent, yet within 2 hours and 15 minutes, 2 people who are willing to spare him or find him not guilty were all of a sudden flipped. Does that concern you?
We may find out the next few days that there was some kind of nefarious thing going on with the jurors.
Just that.
But again, I'll repeat what I said at the beginning. When you're not in the courtroom, I think it's very difficult to really know if someone was guilty or innocent. I remember thinking in trials where people were guilty.
I know.
The jury let them off the hook, and I thought, how could they possibly have done this? And I was sitting in the courtroom listening to somebody all the time. A lot of it has to do with the quality of the attorneys.
I know that.
And I'm not sure in this case if the defense was just not up to the job and the prosecution.
But focus on this for a second. Nancy Gertner said that the lawyer, his defense lawyer, was terrific.
Yep.
And I would take her word at it. But again, let me repeat this one thing, then we'll get back to the calls. According to this one juror, after 45 minutes, 2 people thought a guy was innocent of a double murder, yet in 2 additional hours and 15 minutes, those 2 jurors were persuaded, after having sat through 70 witnesses, they reached a conclusion of not guilty, and then in 2 hours and 15 minutes, their fellow jurors' reasoning convinced
them? Well, it is troubling, Jim. I'll say that. However, I'm not comparing my drunk driving case to a double murder case, particularly when it's your wife and your son. But I think I was once in a drunk driving case. And
you never told me this.
Yes, I did. The guy was totally guilty. I mean, it was absolutely obvious.
Was the guy peeing on the building?
No, that's a different case.
Oh, okay.
That's a different case. That's what I was sued for.
I know you were.
This is somebody that was as a citizen. This was not as a reporter. I was a juror, and the guy was guilty. And we get back to the little jury room, and we go around the table, and everybody says, oh, my God, the guy was sauced. He had huge blood alcohol level and blah, blah, blah. And he went through the plate glass window, and he did a lot of damage and blah, blah, blah. And one person says, well, I'm not sure. And we all looked at him and thought, wow, you're not sure? What did you see that we missed? You know what happened, it turned out, Jim? You get a free lunch when you're a jury in deliberations.
So let's keep it going.
So we get the free lunch. We all order. They give us the menu. Do you want ham and cheese? Do you want a roast beef sandwich? We all ordered. We had a nice lunch. We're all talking around the table. We were talking about the case at that point. Having our sodas, the coffee, whatever it was. As soon as they came in and take lunch away, you know what the guy did? He changed his mind, so I just wanted to have lunch.
Well, I mean, are you surprised? By the way, before we take a break, I want to go back to this. This story on ABC News says it took Moyer, who I assume was one of the jurors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was one of the jurors who believed that he was guilty right away. And the majority, only 45 minutes to turn the holdout. So I'm only going to say this one more time, I promise. They sat through days and days of testimony and 70 witnesses, yet 2 of them thought he was not guilty.
Right.
And 45 minutes later, all these witnesses, 70 witnesses, not guilty. 45 minutes later, 2 people decide, I'm going to switch my vote from not guilty to guilty. Is that an issue?
Well, it could be. I mean, again, you may be right about this. There may have been some browbeating of the 2 people who were trying to hold out and say the guy wasn't guilty. But again, I think court, you know, I think we want to think, we want to get in the weeds in these things. People want to pull out these little threads and say, oh, well, you know, there were no cell phones after 8:48 or 8:49, whatever it is.
They have an answer for that, too, by the way, because his phone was at 2%. That's another point that New York Times editorialist makes. And then the wife... No, he didn't turn it off. The reason he didn't use it is because he knew it was at 2%.
2%, right. Well, I thought that was a theory, that he turned it off because he knew it was only at 2%.
Oh, I see.
Or that the wife's phone was down the driveway. People get lost in the minutiae. But again, the guy took the stand, a guy that has been lying about everything for years, a claim that he had this paranoia from opioids, which caused him to kill his wife and his son to cover up his financial deeds. And they listened to this guy all day long, and nine of them didn't believe him. I don't know that you need to go through all the cell phone records and the 70 witnesses' testimony. We got to take a break. But Jim is claiming that they didn't give this poor guy, Mr. Murdoch.
No, but don't put it that way. No, I think, based on what I saw, that he is a murderer. Mm-hmm. That's not the issue for me. The issue is he's entitled to fair consideration by a jury, and no one can convince me yet, at least, that 3 hours, particularly based upon that one juror's representation, is enough.
And you know what I just want to say in general? When you're a rich guy like this, you can hire the best lawyers going. I mean, O.J. Simpson got the best lawyers going. And I think it's what the real tragedy is, that the prosecution generally doesn't have the money. Mm-hmm. They don't have – the prosecutors are usually out-lawyered when it's a rich person that's in trial. So I find it very heartening that in this case, this man was able to hire the best lawyers he could, and the prosecution still prevailed. It doesn't always happen that way. It's poor people that end up wrongfully convicted because they can't hire good lawyers. Anyway, we're getting your reactions to the Alex Murdaugh verdict, and if you're all concerned as a jury is about the jury's very short 3-hour deliberation time. We'll keep it going after a quick break. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We're broadcasting from the Boston Public Library. We are streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews and facebook.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan live at the library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews or facebook.com/GBHnews. If you're now joining us, we're getting your thoughts and reaction to the end of the biggest trial in America right now, at least, South Carolina lawyer, former lawyer, Alex Murdaugh. Last night, the disgraced lawyer was found guilty of killing his wife and his son, one of his sons. Today, he was sentenced to life in prison without parole. We want to know what your take is on the case and also the take on the speed with which the jury reached unanimity. Did you see, by the way, Marjorie, that over, I meant to say this to you, when they replayed it on CNN, the image, the angle that CNN, the camera person had when Murdaugh was standing there with no emotion, staring at the judge as he was speaking, over his left shoulder was his son. The son, the only living family member who testified in support of his father. And obviously, I guess they didn't buy his line either.
Well, you know, I've mentioned this before. There was the famed pediatrician. He was an expert at asthma, but he treated mostly kids' asthma. Yeah. Grenadier that was convicted of killing his wife, stabbing her to death with the dogs. He didn't hurt the dogs, but he killed her out in this trail, and they lived in Wellesley or something. And they had 3 children, very well educated. I think a couple of them were doctors, mm-hmm. Yale Medical School and all this kind of stuff. And the 3 children came in at the beginning of the trial. I think that they were on their father's side. They believed him. And by the end, the 2 children, older children had realized that this evidence was overwhelming. But the youngest daughter, at least during the trial, I don't know where she is now. This is, like 10 years ago, maybe even more. She stuck with her father through the whole thing. So the children's reactions are very interesting. You know what I wonder about, too? The different stories about the O.J. Simpson children. You know, are they with their father?
Are they?
Well, it's changed. Someone who's followed it more closely maybe can text us. But our brilliant texters here are saying that there were two different guns used, and the theory was that that was to make it look like there were two killers.
Yeah, I want to make something clear. Maybe I didn't. A texter says, just because two jurors weren't ready to vote guilty after 45 minutes doesn't mean they were convinced he was innocent. First of all, they don't have to say he was innocent. They only have to say he was not guilty, which is a different standard. But the juror who spoke, this Moyer, said that they did believe he was innocent after 45 minutes, for whatever that's worth, which apparently is not much.
Couple of people are pointing out that they find it interesting that Netflix released this documentary on the family at the same time this trial was going on. What are the ethics around that? An implication to sway a jury through popular opinion. I presume that they did the voir dire at the beginning of this trial, right? And they asked if they'd seen this Netflix thing or what they thought about the family and all those kind of questions that they do before they select jurors trying to get an impartial jury.
And I'm assuming the judge said don't watch any outside media. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm sure most judges would. Jennifer Nakar, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
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 I was living in Manhattan, and I was called to a murder trial. It was totally circumstantial, no weapon, no witness. And it took us 2 weeks of testimony. When we started deliberation, it was 6 and 6. The second day, it was 9 and 3. And the third day, we convicted him. But we deliberated till midnight both days. And we went back into the court a number of times to have testimony reread. Mm-hmm. And we took it very seriously.
You know, I'm so glad you called because you're articulating far better than I did what my concern is. I mean, it sounds like the reason you were this serious, all 12 of you, about this is because a person's life was at stake. I mean, is that the attitude in the room?
Right. Correct.
And thank you for the call, Jennifer. I guess, Marjorie, even if I should have said this to you before, too, even if they all concluded, well, not all, but ultimately concluded all, that he was such a liar, it didn't matter. Don't you think they had an obligation to do what this caller just suggested her jury did?
Well,
which said, listen, in light of the fact that all we need is reasonable doubt to vote against guilty, let's give it an adequate amount of time. Let's look at some evidence that we preliminary.
I think you're absolutely right that if they'd spent 2 or 3 days, no one would be second-guessing them the way they are now. I mean, I think absolutely the story in the paper this morning in the New York Times when the guy said he was concerned about the speed. I mean, I think it is something that bothers people. I'm just not convinced it's necessarily wrong in the sense that they didn't believe him.
By the way, this, I guess, is our argument on your side. John from Nantucket texts, he wants to know how long it would take for me to convict Trump. Now, that is, that actually, sadly, that's an argument that I cannot counter. I mean, how long is a nanosecond? It's a very brief period of time. I don't even need to hear the witnesses or the testimony. Let's just go right to the deliberations.
Phil in Danvers, thank you for calling.
Hey, Phil.
Hi, Jim, Marjorie.
Hey.
I was on a court case, drunken driving, and I just wanted to make a comment about Jim who was surprised that the two people changed their mind. What happened was it was obvious this person was guilty. You know, like his lawyer, he picked the wrong. His hair was all slicked back, you know, and the way he talks and everything.
Let me tell you, my attitude, Phil, is if your hair is flipped back, guilty. So I'm with you on that. Go ahead.
So his lawyer mentioned that, you know, unfortunately my client was on a prescription. And so when the state trooper pulled him over, he might have been drowsy and stuff. So the other side was the assistant DA, and I think he just got out of law school, but he was sharp. So anyway, he asked to see the medication, and then he looked at the bottle. And then he said to the other attorney, he said, did you know this medication expired 3 years ago? So, you know, so anyway, we had one person that thought he was innocent and we just couldn't believe it. And she was adamant. So we were questioning her and finally she admitted because she was so worked up. She had a thing we found out against state troopers. Because her you know, brother or whatever was arrested by a trooper.
Got it. So what was the outcome? Did she flip?
She flipped. She flipped, but so maybe these two people didn't have all the facts, or these other people just reasoned with them, but it was just obvious, you know, and we were able to flip her.
Well,
thank you, Phil, for the call.
Phil, that was a great call. It's also possible that these two people thought, we can't do this as fast. I mean, it's very possible.
You mean that's the only reason they were saying innocent?
It could be. I don't know. Barb in southeastern Massachusetts just said, I was on a jury for a murder years ago. It took us 3 hours after a week of testimony to acquit. And she makes the point I've made several times. What you hear on the news or on TV is not what the jury hears. We made the decision based on the evidence that we heard.
So
you know, by the way,
they found the ABC, one of our colleagues found the spot this morning, the ABC News exclusive interview. Mm-hmm. Craig Moyer is his name, one of the jurors in the case, about the brevity of their deliberation. Here's what Moyer had to say.
About 45 minutes later, we, after all our deliberating, we figured it out.
So it took basically 45 minutes for you guys to come to a decision?
Probably about 45, maybe an hour.
That's really fast.
Yeah, the evidence was clear.
Okay, so it wasn't 3 hours it took them to decide that this guy was guilty. It took them 45 minutes, 6 weeks of trial, and 70 witnesses. They only needed 12 people, only needed 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. In any case, I'm sure we'll talk to some of the legal experts we have on the show about it in the days
ahead.
Well,
you know, there's something encouraging about it in a way, too.
What do you mean?
That people weren't getting bogged down in these reams of things about phone calls and cell phones and where was this and how come he drove 70 miles an hour and 80 miles. They looked at the guy. They heard the evidence. You know, so many times in court, you think of these cases where, like, the William Kennedy Smith case, right? He was acquitted of a date rape case. He had a great lawyer. And you found out, and this happened with Clarence Thomas as well, that there were other women who had in the Kennedy case the exact same experience as the woman who was on trial, but you can't enter that into evidence because you're supposed to just try the person for the crime committed. Bill Cosby, somehow they managed to get in other people that claim the same kind of case.
I don't think there's a blanket exclusion. It's a discussion. It's
a pattern.
How prejudicial it would be
and
to
demonstrate. And so many times
a
you're sitting in a trial and the jury is excused and then you hear about all the terrible things the defendant had done before this, but we can't mention those because, you know, this would be prejudicial, which is true in a way, but you say to yourself, of course, if the jury knew this, it'd be all over in 2 seconds.
Speaking of the jury being the American people, do you remember who was responsible for barring those additional women from testifying against Clarence Thomas?
Yeah, Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, the chair of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
We got to go.
Okay, we got to go.
We don't have to go.
We haven't resolved this, Jim.
No, apparently
we have
not.
But I'm hoping that in the days to come, we'll get to the bottom of this, and then you can tell me I was right or I was wrong.
Well, we'll talk to people like Andrea Cabral and Nancy Gertner and others and see where they fall. And there's pretty good lawyers.
Okay. Coming up after a quick break, a check-in on the state of Boston's withering downtown scene, plus more Healy's proposal for free community college. Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young has those stories and more. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News. We're joined now by Shirley Young. Shirley is the business columnist for Boston Globe and a weekly BPR contributor. Hi there, Shirley. How are you?
Hi.
Nice
Hi,
to
Jim.
See
Hi,
you.
Marjorie.
Hello, Shirley Young. So let's talk about Governor Healy's first budget proposal, which includes, of course, the $1 billion in the millionaire's tax revenue. What's the over-under?
Over under. That's pretty good.
Jim brought up, by the way, when the governor didn't yesterday, when she was talking about what she was doing, she did not bring up the things she's doing to help people that are very wealthy in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, too. So we can talk about both sides of this budget proposal.
Well, let's talk first about her overall budget. I mean, from the business community, there were a lot of fans of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, she talked about tax relief. She talked about estate tax reform, something that Governor Baker wanted to do and never got done. I was a little surprised by cutting the short-term capital gains from 12% to 5%. And so I think for this first pass, the business community was very happy with it, even though many of them were against the millionaire's tax, which yep. she supported. And out of the gate, it looks like the money will be almost half and half, right? Education, transportation.
Yeah.
Because that money raised the new millionaire's tax on incomes over $1 million, the money is supposed to go to education, transportation. It looks like it will. And I think the bulk of the education is higher ed, right?
I believe a lot. Well, I don't
a
know.
Lot
if it's
a lot of it is a higher ed. Yeah. So, and part of that is this free community college proposal.
Which I think is great, but yes. Especially since community colleges are so often people who have been in the workforce for financial reasons, then decide to go back and finish their degrees. So they're probably more strapped than the average college person, right. Even though the average college person is strapped too. I think it's a great solution to a really important problem.
You know what I thought about the, the help to the wealthy, you probably don't need that much help, that it was going to, that might make it more palatable to the legislature and to people, if you have support from the business community and progressives who weren't thrilled, but there were a lot of good things. That's what I thought.
Well, here's what, let's play what she said. We asked her about when the governor yesterday listed the, what Marjorie was referencing, the taxes in her tax cutting plan, she didn't list the two that were for wealthier residents, the things you just mentioned a minute ago, and then we asked her about them. Here she is talking about the proposed change to the estate tax, for example.
We did the math, we did the analysis, we looked at what kind of households would be affected by this. I proposed lifting that cap to $3 million. As I say, Massachusetts also is an outlier. Only 12 states even have an estate tax, and at $1 million, we're the lowest state in the country along with, we have the lowest cap in the country along with the state of Oregon. So, I understand it's a subject of debate, but honestly, I am focused on affordability and I am focused on competitiveness.
And essentially what she's saying is all the other taxes she did list are about affordability for renters, for example, the child credit, which is a great thing she's proposing. And these two that do go, she didn't challenge our assertion that they go to wealthier people. It isn't about equity. It's about competitiveness, and she doesn't want to lose. Which leads me to ask you, I am totally convinced that you and your voicemail must have, I don't know, thousands of people who made more than a million last year who are saying,
I'm moving to New Hampshire.
The moving truck should be here in, 11 minutes. How many so far have you heard from, Shirley?
I haven't heard from them yet.
Oh, you haven't?
I've heard from some, but we are looking into this. How many people are moving?
Yeah.
But as you know, when you talk to...
Because that was the primary argument against this.
Right.
Is all these, either you're going to be a one-time millionaire when you sell your farm, or wealthy people are going to move to Florida.
But there is movement, I guess. Some business leaders want to pass legislation to exempt so-called one-time millionaires.
I know they do.
And so that is happening, or at least is in the works. And then in terms of, when you talk to financial planners, a lot of them do advise their wealthy clients, if you can, you should live somewhere else with the lower income tax exposure. And oftentimes it's not having a moving truck, but they already have a home. Maybe in New Hampshire or Florida, and so.
But you can't lie. Don't you have to live in that place 6 months plus a day
or
something?
Right. So organize yourself so that you can spend, at least 6 months of the year there.
I wasn't clear then. How many of those people have called you on the phone and left your voicemail saying, "I'm now going to spend"? I mean, this argument was such BS. But when they do call, you'll let us know.
I will. You might even read about them.
We might in the Boston Globe, correct.
I think it might be people who do this. They may be people whose children are growing up. They're not worried about, because you think you're going to relocate your kids to save some money when you're that low to begin with, and you're going to take them out of schools and bring them to New Hampshire schools. I mean, I don't think so. But it might be if you are retired or your kids are in private school or something like that. I could see where you might.
If you chose Massachusetts and you're loaded, chose Massachusetts as the place to live. I assume you chose it because you love all that comes with it. The arts, culture, great restaurants, great neighbors. You love, your kids love their friends they grew up with. And because of this fairly modest surcharge on people, again, making more than $1 million a year, people are going to uproot themselves.
Well,
and
they're
say,
not. As Shirley said, they're not uprooting.
Not
they
yet.
Already have their place in some nice place down in Florida, and they're just going to spend more of the time down in Florida because they don't like the cold, Jim.
Actually, you know what we should do? For all the millionaires listening to the show right now who are moving out of state, could you call 877-301-8970? Thank you. We'll get back to that.
So your colleague, Didi Coley, had a great piece about the neighborhoods of Boston, Alston, Hyde Park, Dorchester, Mattapan, thriving post-pandemic, while poor downtown Boston is really having a tough time getting the little small businesses, little sandwich shops to thrive like they are.
No, this was a great piece from Didi based off of, actually, she looked at credit card data.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
And
actually,
how there was more spending in those residential neighborhoods. I mean, if you think about it, I was thinking like, oh, this is such a perfect story for Mayor Wu, right? Mm-hmm. And she, Mayor Wu, I'm thinking because she campaigned on building up the residential neighborhoods and less so. And the idea that downtown can probably, downtown is can survive on its own, though she is doing more for downtown. But it's what she was running on as mayor is to bring more, I guess, activity and business to all the other neighborhoods.
But
it's
because of something she did? Or because the COVID, the impact of COVID. You were the first columnist to write about this years ago, that downtown really was decimated by COVID and it hasn't built back.
Right. No, I'm not saying it's something she has done. It's just like she happens to be the mayor now, where this is something that she has championed, that we need to bring more activity and business to other parts of Boston, not just downtown.
You know, we should have asked her this, but when she's back, we'll ask her. So we'll ask you in the meantime. What is the plan, though? What is the Wu plan to, I don't know if this is too strong a word, to revitalize downtown? I know she appointed the other day somebody
who's the
czarina of nightlife, which I think is great, by the way. It really creates. But what other things is she doing?
I mean, she's talked about empty storefronts and reimagining them, bringing in different kinds of businesses or childcare or perhaps even arts. You know, I mean, I think they're thinking outside the box. But it's not just Boston. I mean, right? San Francisco is in the same boat, and it could be years before there is, a return of office workers.
I mean, when you
at
think about
level.
It, it makes perfect sense. If you had to be downtown your office 5 days a week, then you're going to bring your dry cleaning there. You're going to get your shoes done there. You're going to get all these things done. If you're home 2 days a week, you're just going to bring it right to the dry cleaner that in your neighborhood. You know what I mean? All those services that you would use downtown for.
And if you're not going downtown, you probably are. Actually, I know my dry cleaning bill is a lot smaller.
That's right.
You can wear sweats and, and fleece all day.
Well, I have also discovered that all the things you said, they say you have to dry clean, is not necessarily true.
I've discovered that too during the pandemic.
Silk shirts, you don't have to dry clean this. You can just
put it in a mesh bag and you throw it in the damn washer.
Right, put it on delicate. Delicate and wool light.
Wool light. Doesn't smell great.
I thought I read a column of yours. You were biking to work every day. Didn't you write that column? You wrote that column, right?
I did. Not every day.
How many times have you done it?
Just that one time.
Okay. You know, Shirley.
Well, you know, but remember the rule. When I went with the rule was that you can only maybe not go now because you got to wait for daylight savings because it gets
it's only
too
a week
dark.
Away, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I might bring out the bike.
Okay. Surely. By the way, the mayor is back. I didn't realize this. Jamie just told me on March 14th at 11 o'clock here at the library. So we'll ask her about downtown because I know she does care about.
He's picking on you. You know, don't let him do it. He's picking on you.
He is.
Yes, he is. Absolutely.
She wrote it, Marjorie. You know
okay.
I mean?
So tell us about MassBio's new CEO. And exactly, the headline was don't take your foot off the gas right now. So that presumes we are taking our foot off the gas. And why does that matter?
This is about the new MassBio CEO, Kendall Berlin O'Connell. And she just started in January. And the previous MassBio CEO, Joe Bancori, former state senator, he didn't last very long. He lasted a year, and that was it. And now she's in, and she's the first, really, in a long time, first non-for, you know, not like true, you know, business leader, not former state legislator.
Right.
Because before Boncori, it was Bob Coughlin, a state rep, and then before that, I think Tom Finneran was also ran MassBio briefly. And so so this marks a big change for MassBio, and at a time when they're going to the legislature asking for another big check. You may recall Deval Patrick started a billion-dollar life sciences initiative. Governor Baker continued it, and now that money is dries up this June. So they're right in the middle of asking for more money.
Baker did it too, right?
Yeah, Baker did it too. And so they're asking for more money. So it's a very unusual time to have a non-legislator to ask for this big money.
But, it's an interesting piece. A piece of that story is that Mark Montigny, who's been a state senator for a long time, said he votes against all these funding things because he doesn't believe the legislature should be involved in picking winners and losers, was his expression, which a lot of experts in the area beat. Is MassBio's position, and obviously it's a huge part of important sector, is their position is that in every successive administration, we need a huge influx of state money? Or do they acknowledge at some point they're doing so well that essentially this was startup cash, for lack of a better expression?
Oh, no, they want more money. I mean, this is why the quote from the headline is, we can't take our gas, our foot off the pedal.
So is there going to be more money?
Well, that's what I raise in my piece. I mean, one could argue that life sciences, I mean, it's one of the hottest industries right now, if it's slowing a little bit. But when you look at real estate, the only thing that's getting built are labs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so why is life sciences mature enough that it doesn't need state money?
And clean energy, you point out.
Right. I think clean energy is where life sciences was 20 years ago. So perhaps the state should bet on clean energy and needs more money. I mean, MassBio and the life science industry would say, no, if we want to remain competitive globally, we need more money for research, for startups. And so that will be a big debate, I think, on Beacon Hill, whether or not life sciences needs more money.
So did Boncori get canned? Or, I mean, 1 year is a pretty short tenure.
It depends on who you
ask. More time with his family.
Depends on who you ask.
Okay.
What
did he say?
He did not talk to me.
I think that's your answer, don't you think?
Though he is still on the payroll of MassBio, he's still as a consultant, and so he only lasted a year. Some people think he was pushed out. Some people think that Kendall was the right person after all. Now, she was a longtime executive at MassBio beforehand, and she was basically the number two.
You know what I love that you pointed out is something that is too common among women. I mean, this woman obviously very capable, but that you get asked her whether she thought she was subject to that women thing where, well, I don't know if I can handle this kind of responsibility. You know, women and men are different about that.
Right.
Elaborate on that.
So I asked Kendall, do you regret not, because I assume she had applied for the job the first time, and she said, no, I didn't. The lead job has been more about policy and being the external face. That's not me. I'm more operations and business side. But in the year when Bob Coughlin stepped down, and I think the search lasted 6 or 7 months, she had to do both jobs. She had to be the policy person, the external face, and run the operations. And she discovered, I kind of liked it, And so when the opportunity came, she felt ready to be the CEO of MassBio.
Shirley, you wrote a piece, I think it's in today, about the turnover in leadership at John Hancock. And brought it up for a couple of reasons beyond the fact that you wrote it. Is one of your great qualities is not only are you a fierce advocate for organizations and governments and voters to pick women to lead organizations that have historically only been led by men, generally white men. But the second thing that struck me about this woman leaving after only 5 years, the first woman head of John Hancock, is when I moved here 30 years ago or plus, and then 20 years ago, and then 10 years ago, well, I'm not involved in the business community at all. Even without your guidance, I could probably name 10 downtown business leaders who mattered. I cannot tell a lie. I didn't even remember the name of this woman until you wrote about it today. Is that a function of the fact that all of the names of people that we did know were heads of organizations that were based here, and when they became the subsidiaries of parent companies like John Hancock is, which is now owned by a company in Toronto, their, quote, investment in our community is less. Is that what it's a function of?
It's different now. I mean, I would say 20, 30 years ago, everybody knew who the active CEOs were.
Like, exactly.
Of John Hancock was David D'Alessandro. Sure. Right. But that was because John Hancock was based here.
I think, yeah.
And today, you know, not only is John Hancock owned by Manulife of Toronto, it's a global company.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why this is the last year they are the principal sponsor of the Boston
that's
Marathon.
A good point, yeah.
Their business model
and Fenway too.
Fenway. Yeah. It's just a different business. And if you think about, we don't know a lot of this. It's different now. A lot of the CEOs, you know, what used to be the bank and finance, yep, and insurance CEOs, you knew all their names and they were very active. But today, those same CEOs, they're traveling all the time, or it's a more global business. It's not just about Boston or Massachusetts anymore. And so it's a little bit different these days. But Marian Harrison's been around 5 years, first woman to run Hancock since its founding in the 1860s. And now Brooks Tingle, a longtime executive at John Hancock, ran the insurance businesses, which is one of life insurance, which is
Brooks Tingle his real name?
Yeah.
It is?
I know.
My God, that's
Brooks
a good
Tingle.
One. Okay, sorry to get you off track there, but I thought that was a made-up thing. Brooks Tingle.
Sounds very like, you know, the Pilgrim's Time.
Okay,
exactly.
Maybe
he's from New Hampshire. He's from New Hampshire. Okay. Before Marianne, there was a revolving door of Hancock CEOs. And so 5 years is actually a long time under Manulife. And now Brooks is going to be there. Brooks has been there for 35 years at John Hancock. So I don't think he's going to go anywhere.
Shirley, I just want to say, since we're out of time, when those people have made more than $1 million, when they call you, don't wait for your usual spot on the show. Just call in.
Well,
we don't
are they
care
calling
what we're
you?
Doing.
Didn't you just... 877, right? Didn't you
877-381-8970.
Well, as the line goes, when the phone don't ring, you know it's for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Shirley.
Shirley, it's great to see you.
We've been speaking with Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young, who joins us every week and writes great stuff in the Boston Globe.
She does.
She is a Boston... She's a big deal, let me tell you. She's like Miss Must Read in the Boston Globe.
She
That's what
Miss
I hear,
Must
Shirley.
Read, actually.
Anyway, she's a weekly contributor here, and we're really grateful for her time. Coming up, we're going to talk with Callie Crossley. GBH's Callie Crossley, a legend in the world of Boston journalism, passes the torch to the next generation. Callie's going to talk about... What?
I thought you were talking about Callie, that she
was
passing the torch.
Well, she, of course, is a legend as well, but this is a different legend that we're going to...
She was nervous for
tell
a second
everybody
there.
About. Yeah, she's not passing the torch, as far as we know. Okay, she's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We're at the Boston Public Library.
I'm Jim Browning, head on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Vincent Pastore played Big Pussy on The Sopranos, whacked at the end of season 2. He's going to be in town next week for a Sopranos Q&A with a few other cast members at the Bach Schubert Theater. He'll join us to reflect on what may be the greatest show ever and everything else he's been up to.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Then it's GBH's arts and culture reporter, James Bennett II, plus Live Music Friday with GBH's Brian O'Donovan, his wife Lindsay, guitarist Keith Murphy, and fiddle player Katie McNally, ahead of a Celtic Sojourn St. Patrick's Day concert. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Oops.
Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome back to hour number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library, as we do every Tuesday and every Friday. And we are streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews and facebook.com/GBHnews.
Let me just say, I don't want to be a bad sport, but I just want to say this and then we'll move on.
Yep.
I was just told by Jamie, our lead producer, that the Marjorie sandwich has sold out. and that there are plenty of Jim sandwiches available.
Woo! Very happy about that. They are, of course, superior sandwiches, I would like to say.
Boy, does he know how to break a guy's spirit.
Thank you very much.
That is really bad news. In any case, we're joined now by GBH's Kelly Crossley. She's the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here in 89.7 at 6. Also the host of Basic Black, which airs Friday at 7:30. And you can hear her Kelly commentaries on Mondays for GBH's Morning Edition. And as you know, she performs Thursday night in the lounge. Right. Kelly Crossley,
right.
It's great to see you. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim. I'm Margie.
Hey there.
So, Kelly Crossley, I was saying to you before, before we started that I was always, Melvin Miller's 88 years old. He's run the Bay State Banner forever. He's passing the torch. But I always got a kick out of him. He would call me at the Herald and tell me what I did wrong and dig right and give me a hard time about things. But I really admired him and the work he did. So, elaborate. You know his paper very well. You know him very well.
Oh, well, I think this... Well, first of all, have we said that this is the story is that it's now been passed to a new set of hands. I'm very excited about this. I actually met Ron Mitchell on Martha's Vineyard this summer.
Oh, really?
He's a mentee of Tanya Hart. And so she introduced me, and that's how we ended up having a conversation. And just very excited about all of this. And his plans for the paper, along with his partner, Andre Stark. And I think you can't say enough about how valuable the paper has been and what the work that Mel put into it to bring it to the place that it's been. So good time to pass the torch and an excellent time to expand the vision of what the newspaper, because now it's going to be multi-platform, can be. I'm just very excited about it.
By the way, my understanding is both of these guys, Mitchell and Stark, both have GBH connections. One has made films here for Frontline, GBH TV, and Nova. And I can't remember what the other connection is, but I heard on our air last night, I think it was, that they both have GBH roots, which
is
great
to hear.
And
Ken Cooper, who used to be here.
Oh, right, I forgot about that.
He's going to be a consultant. He used to be at the Globe, too.
Yeah.
And at GBH, right?
Yes, that's right. And you know what I love about this story that they talk about back in 1967, that the Banner had a story about the headline was Police Riot in Grove Hall, about police officers storming this welfare building and clubbing protesting welfare mothers. You know, you might not have seen that
elsewhere
no, in 1967.
Right. Well, they've been doing that kind of work forever. I was just sharing with Shirley that I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and the Tri-State Defender, which was the black newspaper, was regular reading for us. They, at that time, had two newspapers in town, and that was the third. And my mother would get three and four other ones because she was just a different kind of person. She liked a lot of opinions on across the board.
Well, that's good. Good for her.
No, it was. It really was. It was eye-opening for her children, which is what she meant it to be. But my point is that these... they're hyper-local newspapers. Community newspapers really mean something. We are blessed to have a number of them in various communities here in Boston. And there are just stories in there that you will not see anyplace else. But they're very meaningful to what's going on, you know, in your life or what's going on in the city. So they have an opportunity not only to tell more of the story of what's happening, certainly in black communities and communities of color in Boston. They're going to expand regionally. But I would maintain that people from across the country will also reach out because they're very interested in those kinds of stories from other places as well.
And to reiterate, this is at a time when small newspapers, independents, are collapsing at a shocking rate.
Yeah.
And here's a situation where Miller has basically found two people who are going to re-energize and, as you say, expand it, which is a pretty exciting and unusual
I'm
story.
I'm really excited about it. I can't wait.
Good luck. You know, we should invite him on, by the way.
Oh, we should.
Does he have stories to tell.
He has stories to tell, and he's a hot ticket.
You mean Melvin Miller.
Yeah,
yes.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah, yes.
Really looking forward to it. We're talking to Kelly Crossley here at the Boston Public Library.
So, Kelly Crossley, Minnesota is creating the nation's first office investigating missing black women, and it talks about how there are 60,000 black women, statistics tell us, that are missing.
Nationally.
Correct. And they make the point that they don't get the attention. Yeah. It's called the missing white woman syndrome that we've talked about before, that they don't get the attention when the blue-eyed blondes are missing. We have had that right here in Massachusetts.
And they're missing at three times their rate in the population at large. Right. So it's pretty significant.
Right.
Yeah. We talked to Marcella Garcia about this kind of situation in Boston, in East Boston, where a woman was missing. And the
Raina
case.
Rojas, yes.
Yes. Yeah. And the case got almost no attention.
Right.
She claims by the police, never mind by the public.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a really, this would be a first of its kind in the United States. This office that they're setting up, and potentially could be a model because of the numbers that you just mentioned about black women. But it, women of color, in the larger sense, 100,000 out of the 250,000 women went missing in the U.S. during the pandemic. So when you talk about a Rojas, and that she would be included in that number if it happened during that time. And the point is that often they just don't, A, get the attention or the follow-up. And so if you have some institutionalized either organizations or systems put in place where that could automatically kick in to have some attention paid to it, who knows? You know, we know from police the way that they go after missing people is the earlier the better to have information right after they are deemed to be actually missing. So the longer you wait, and now from Marcella Garcia's story about Raina Rojas, she's been gone for since November 26th.
Thanksgiving, yeah.
So that is really problematic.
You know, I read a lot of I read a handful of comments on this the story that caused us to talk about this, and almost every one of the commenters said, "Why is this necessary?" And I think about Maura Healey was standing there yesterday, elevating Veterans Affairs to a cabinet level. Well, why are you doing that? Because we want to make sure that clear that we have a laser-like focus on how veterans are treated. Her chief equity officer, or whatever, her chief climate officer. This makes a statement, and I think also makes it easier for people in power to be held accountable when it's higher profile. Not to mention that hopefully we'll rescue or find some of these missing women. So I think it's great they're doing it, and I don't know if it's in the Attorney General's office or where, but it would be a wonderful thing if Massachusetts followed suit.
Well, I'm sure they're going. Everybody's going to be looking at it as a model. So in about a year, maybe we'll see what happens elsewhere.
So.
But they are setting the pace right now in Minnesota.
We're talking to Cal Crossey, another local legend. She was saying I was confusing her with Melvin Miller before.
Yeah, I was like,
no, she was shocked because you started saying a local legend is retiring.
That's right.
And she thought, am I retiring?
No one told me.
No one told you.
That's the worst kind of retirement, by the way, and they don't tell you.
So Disney's Peter Pan is going to be a new movie, and they've cast a black Tinkerbell. This has made some people very happy, and it has made some people very ticked off.
It's Yara Yashida, to be specific, and she's a graduate of Harvard and was the star of the series Blackish and then on to Grownish and many other pieces, but I think people would know her from those two big.
It's a very funny show.
It's a very funny show, and she's adorable. And as many people have said when this came up, when we were talking about Ariel being a young black woman, Halle Bailey is doing that role. You know, fairies aren't real. So they could actually be anybody.
That's a really good point, Kelly.
And so that's the thing that's very confusing. Now, what I thought was interesting in this latest criticism about Yara having this role is that they were using a term I'd never heard before called blackwashing. I've heard, you know, of course, we've heard of whitewashing. So some people have argued that there is some move now to just, like, blackwash, quote, unquote, every role that comes up.
That's like a Ron DeSantis line, isn't it? I mean, that's what he would say. Yeah.
Yes, I was like, wow, well, that's interesting. So, you know, we'll see. She's an excellent actress. So if people come to the Peter Pan production and just to enjoy it, I mean, she'll do her part very well. But if folks are really put off by the fact that she happens to be African-American, well, I guess they won't see her.
You know what I was just thinking about? I'm sure I thought about it because of one of my favorite stories you've ever told us is when you flew out for the day to Chicago to meet your friends, to have a great lunch, see Hamilton, which were cheaper tickets, and then flew back after
the day. Yeah.
Did Hamilton, was that the groundbreaker on this issue? Because I remember there was some, what is it with people of color playing white historical figures, and then it became so huge. Was that like the tipping point, or
I don't know. No, that's an interesting cultural question. I do not know. We'd have to ask somebody much smarter than me about whether that
or
was
us.
A, or the tipping point. But needless to say, if people go back to that time, you know, everybody is awash in all of the attention that Hamilton got, all of the accolades, all of the awards, and they forgot. There was a lot of pushback about, you know, the casting until people saw the production and said, oh, well, I guess you could go with that. So maybe that mm-hmm. no doubt it was a huge influence. Had to be.
Yeah. You know,
and I don't think a lot of people realize, I certainly didn't realize that Hamilton was an immigrant until I saw the play, which must have been downplayed because I certainly studied the Federalist
Papers. Isn't that one of Miranda's major points?
Yes,
I mean, celebrate immigrants.
Let's quote from Hamilton. Yeah. Immigrants, we get the job done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right?
And a genius.
Yeah.
Wrote so many. I mean, Federalist Papers. I mean, that was basically Hamilton,
I know.
Right?
Well, it's amazing. I mean, I didn't know that much about Hamilton, which was the point of the whole thing. Yeah, so we learned a lot, right?
Yeah. I knew he died in a duel. I didn't know his son died in a duel before he died.
And his wife continued
to
live after. Oh, this is a spoiler alert if you haven't seen Hamilton.
Well, I
you
think
can
after
do it.
200 years,
yeah,
you can
yeah,
do
we
it.
Yeah, we can do the spoiler alert. How great the wife was.
Yeah.
And who knew that he was really in love with her sister.
Yeah, yes, really.
She had a tough time, huh?
I know.
Different time, though. So let's.
That's right. They were tougher back in those days.
I don't know this guy at all. I know of the guy, Brian Flores.
Yeah.
But I love him. I mean, the fact that somebody is willing, and he can't be older than his late 40s, maybe early 50s. He's an assistant football coach looking for a full-time job. And because he asserts that he was told by his boss when he was with the Dolphins, where he was the coach, that you had to lose. I'll give you $100,000 for every game you lose because then we'll get a better draft pick and all that. And he refused, and he thinks as a result he was discriminated against. To sue your employer when you intend to stay in the industry.
That is correct.
Especially a closed industry with only 32 job opportunities.
Right.
That's all there are. 32, right. I think so. I love him. And there was a recent decision that, you know, I don't want to get lost in the weeds, but tell people what the status of his litigation is.
So the judge said that he can go ahead and press his discrimination claims against the league and three teams. Now, it's interesting because arbitration plays a role here. So one of his issues will have to go to arbitration, which means that he could presumably be in front of Roger Goodell himself, because
right.
Roger Goodell would
who's
be
presiding
the,
over the discrimination,
arbitration.
Right.
And the judge left a little window open that said, okay, if it ends up that you were there and in front of Roger Goodell, I still will maintain some authority that I could step in if it gets stickier than that. But beyond that, she allowed him to go forward without arbitration on one of the claims, which is big. First of all, you're right. Just suing your boss is amazing. But also knowing when you sued your boss that, to my knowledge, has there been another successful suing like this? I don't think there has been. So you pretty much go into it thinking, I'm probably going to lose this, and I want to stay in the industry, to your point. So this could be the end of my career.
Well, you have to give credit to the teams. An assistant coach for, I think, Pittsburgh, maybe, this season. Now he's going to, I think, Minnesota.
He's on the Vikings now.
Yeah. I mean, you got to give those teams credit, too, for, I mean, obviously, he's somebody who the big shots in the league are troubled about. But, I mean, that's a lot of courage. And
sure
also,
is.
I mean, the point, there's a beautiful part of the story. The judge who made the decision gratuitously goes out of her way, I think it was a woman judge, to say, there's something wrong with this picture here, in addition to ruling on the arbitration versus court proceeding, saying, wait a second, 70% of the players are black. Mm-hmm. Only one of the coaches is black. And then she goes on to do that comparison. I thought that was both gratuitous and pretty wonderful at the same time.
You're the big union guy. Yeah. Why should there be arbitration at all here?
Because they sign contracts, according
to
the
judge.
No, why
do they agree to it is what Marjorie said.
How is that thought to be fair? I mean, we see what happens certainly locally in arbitration.
Well, the answer to the question is, I think the weakest players' union of all the professional sports by far is the NFL Players Association. Maybe Marty Walsh should have gone to them instead of the hockey people.
Yeah.
But they are generally weak, and the employer comes in and says, I'll give you an extra $100. Mm-hmm. I'm making that up, of course, in return for which we don't want to have to go through the expense and trouble of a court proceeding. We'll just resolve it internally. Why would a union ever agree to that? Weakness, I would say, is probably the answer. Ever.
Huh.
Huh.
Yeah, because the two guys that joined on to his lawsuit, they have to go to arbitration.
But the Boston Police Union is very, very powerful, and we've talked a million times about how their cases go to arbitration.
Because they do better. Their history is they do better in arbitration. They like arbitration. They do better, at least in that circumstance, than they do in the courts. In any case, can we discuss the really important topic here?
Yeah, sure. What is
Shamrock Shake. And I'm trying to develop a reputation as a mini foodie. And however, this is going to destroy it. I actually like the milkshakes
at
McDonald's. Oh, you did
too? No, I like the Shamrock Shake particularly.
I've never had the Shamrock Shake.
Are you kidding?
Excuse me. Sorry.
I wait all year for it to come.
Do you really?
Yeah.
And it was so great.
I don't know. It's minty, and I like the mint, you know. And it's green. What the hell? What's it like to like about a green minty thing?
But when you read about it, it's mostly air. The milkshake that doesn't
taste like air.
Doesn't taste like air.
Now, for me personally, it comes with a lot of whipped cream. I don't like the whipped cream, so I take that. I get that off. But it's only here for a couple of weeks.
So you really got to go for it.
Yeah, I did last night because it goes.
You didn't. Is that really true?
Yes, that's really true.
That is unbelievable.
I was leaving the office and everybody said, damn, I'm going to go get one too.
I don't think the Shamrock Shake is nearly as exciting as the lazy cinnamon rolls.
Oh, talk about that.
Yes. The ones in the mug. Let me just say one thing. This really annoys me when people in recipes, they say, oh, it takes 2 minutes to do this and 2 minutes to do that. That's ridiculous. It never takes 2 minutes to do anything. But this is a very clever idea.
Yeah.
Easy cinnamon rolls
in a mug. It does take 2 minutes in a mug.
You think so?
Oh, yeah, because otherwise you destroy it because you're microwaving it.
Well, I mean, to put it together, though. Can you do all this in two minutes?
Well, you just put it in the mug, though. You're not, like, you know, rolling, you know, it's a small thing.
Okay.
People make little cakes in mugs, too, you know.
They do?
Yeah, it's a big deal. Cake in a mug.
I did not know that either.
Yeah.
But this was accompanied by saying you could make cinnamon rolls in a mug in, like, 2 minutes or... Even prep time was 2 minutes, which I was skeptical about. I didn't realize that the huge role of cinnamon rolls
have
played all across the country. I mean, there's a whole big story about how cinnamon rolls is one of the wonders of wintertime eating.
Recently, this is like a new trend thing that everybody's into cinnamon rolls. I mean, it's great for Pillsbury because you know what's going to happen.
Well, that's
you're going to read the recipe and you're going to say, "I'm going home and I'm going to do that," and then you're going to say, "You know what? I could get a can of Pillsbury."
Well, I mean, I think I've probably done the Pillsbury cinnamon rolls about 500 times in my life. I mean, you know, when I had my kids, I did it for myself. I still
that's 2 minutes.
That is 2 minutes. Yeah, but I mean, you're a big foodie person.
Yeah. No, I
didn't. Do you have a relationship with cinnamon rolls?
No, I mean, I like them, but I didn't realize this was a huge thing until recently.
Yeah,
but
well,
it makes sense. It's warm. It's in the wintertime. It's, you know, sweet. And,
you know what this just reminded me of? We've done a number of shows about what are the favorite foods from your kidhood that stay with you. And you know what I've forgotten until this moment?
Because
it's almost the only thing. Yeah. No, the only thing I could make is cinnamon toast.
Oh, yeah, I love
just popped a piece of toast in, you buttered it, and you shook the cinnamon on it, and you felt like you were in heaven.
Okay, listen to this. This
There's many ways of doing it.
This is from something called Bake Magazine. Mm-hmm. Nearly a quarter of Americans reported eating more breakfast foods during COVID-19 pandemic than normal.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Four in five said they've eaten breakfast foods outside of breakfast time, and one of the most popular breakfast foods during both traditional and non-traditional hours at 34% is the cinnamon roll.
Well... Let me just start with the breakfast hours thing. Yeah. I am from the South. Breakfast is all day, every day. When I moved here, I was like, what do you mean it's 10 o'clock and it's over? What are you talking about?
Is that right?
Absolutely.
So you can go get the steak and eggs at 6 o'clock at time?
Wait a second. You don't have breakfast for dinner from time to time?
It's a
have
fabulous an omelet.
Treat.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the greatest thing.
I'm with you.
I love it.
Anyway, they were talking about combining cinnamon rolls with chili. I don't know if I want to do that.
No, that doesn't do it for me. I like the sweet ones, but people are doing savory takes. This is just a big deal for whatever reason, and I don't know. So, you know, things come and things go. That's all right.
Well, Yahoo.com has the recipe for cinnamon rolls in a mug. Claims it takes 2 minutes to
prepare.
When
do you think you'll be doing that, Marjorie? Never.
I'm not much of a cook. Why don't you try it over the weekend?
I actually can bring it in
on Monday and I'll have a taste.
I intend to do that over the weekend.
All right. What do you got in
your show? What are you doing this weekend, Kelly?
I am doing a follow-up that I did about a year and a half ago about not just the ditching of cable, but the whole wild, wild west of streaming and where consumers are. And if people are paying attention, you may know that streaming services are now... You know, trying to figure out how the future for them. A lot of them are suffering some loss of the kind of support that they had maybe some people said that got pumped up during COVID, but they got to figure it out. And those of us who like streaming services have to figure out how many can we afford to have and why and all of that. So it's really a cultural piece about, you know, how we get our entertainment and even some of our news. People are moved on to these platforms for that. And then the second part is, you know, just one that's troubling that you've talked about a little bit here, of course, is that the cutbacks in the federal cutbacks in the SNAP benefits. Yeah. And that's the context for a conversation I was going to have anyway about culturally relevant foods at food banks and why food banks are really trying to move in that direction.
Oh.
So Catherine D'Amato from the Greater Food Bank is talking with me, as well as Jennifer Johnson from Gaining Ground, which is a regenerative farm in Concord, and all they do is make produce that they give away to food banks. And they all have can tell you that food insecurity has not gone away. It's gotten worse before these cutbacks. So they're bracing for impact on that. And, you know, I talk about food insecurity, people being hungry, quite a bit, because I think we just need to understand that the folks that are going to food banks or turning to them as a last resort or trying to pull it all together at the end of the month for their families or themselves are mostly working. I have gotten into huge fights with people who think they just take. Nobody wants to work. These people are working. I just can't emphasize that enough.
And sometimes two jobs and they still can't swing it.
I know. And we're, you know, and now with, you know, food inflation, the food costs, I mean, it's really hard. It's hard for the food banks. It's hard for the folks who are out here who've been trying to piece it together before. So it's, anyway, it's an interesting and just good conversation about, know, what we can do, the rest of us, if we're privileged not to have to be in that position, but just to be aware that there are many among us, you'd be surprised, who are going to food banks and who are food insecure.
In our state. I mean, I'm so glad you said that, because when we talk to either D'Amato or somebody from Project Bread, whatever it is, the notion is it's over there that this happens.
Right.
What is it, one in six or stunning number of people go to bed hungry?
And then people say, I'll acknowledge that it's there, but we have food banks, so why do we have to have federal programs? For every one meal that a food bank can provide, SNAP provides five. That's why. It's just they can't fill the gap. They can't. No matter how much they'd want to and how many volunteers and how much food is donated, they just cannot.
You know, I remember when the government shut down during the Trump administration, I forget for how long it was, and federal workers, some of them were paid so poorly that within 2 weeks they were at food banks because they were out of any money. They had they didn't have any savings.
Right.
And that was a real shocker to
remember
me.
Jose Andres was feeding a lot of them.
That's
because they were in such horrible
situations. That you work for the federal government and the pay is so bad that you'd be at food banks.
Well, you remember Walmart got in trouble back in the day, and they've claim to have fixed that now.
With their low wages.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, let's hope they fixed it.
Yeah. Okay, Kelly Crossey, it was great to see you. We'll be listening and watching. See you
soon.
Thank you,
Kelly Crossey. Kelly Crossey is host of the Under the Radar with Kelly Crossey. Under the Radar, I should say, with Kelly Crossey.
What did you say, Under the Radio?
I don't know what I said. I said I mispronounced something.
That too, I think.
That's a surprise.
A living legend, Under the Radar.
Right.
Oh, and congratulations on your retirement, by the way, which we didn't know about. Thank you.
Under the Radar is Sunday nights right here at 89.7 at 6 o'clock. Kelly is also the host of Basic Black, which airs Fridays at 7:30. That's tonight. And you can hear her Kelly commentaries on Monday for GBH's Morning Edition. Maybe there'll be one on cinnamon rolls this Monday. We can only hope. Anyway, after a quick break, we're getting a lot of texts about this. Brian O'Donovan is coming up later in the show, too, with a preview of Celtic Sojourns. That's really something to stay tuned for. But we're also going to talk.
Not just the music, but Brian.
Yes. Brian's here, and some great music is going to be here, too.
Yep.
But we're also going to talk up next with GBH culture reporter James Bennett II and a movie about a bear goes on a cocaine-fueled rampage that's grossed nearly $400 million already. James Bennett II is next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7, broadcasting from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, live at the library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News. We're joined now by GBH Arts and Culture reporter James Bennett II. He's the man behind GBH's The Drop, a list of things to do in and around Boston that will ideally bring you some joy without cratering your bank account. Hello there, James.
Hi.
Good to see you.
Well, so I can't wait another second. We're going to start with this movie. I watched the trailer this morning with Jim. I couldn't believe it. It's called Cocaine Bear. As I said before the break, huge hit, apparently, where characters Henry... Oh, well, that's a clip. But it's about a bear that ingests all this cocaine, goes on a rampage. So we're going to get a little sound, get in the mood here. This is when characters Henry and Peter have climbed a tree to escape the abnormal bear.
There's something wrong with it.
Yeah, I told you there was.
Why is it acting like this? Did you feed it cocaine?
No, but you're safe. Bears can't climb trees.
Of course they can.
Then why are you up here?
So this has become a massive hit, apparently. What's going on with the bear?
So what went on with the bear, because this is inspired by true events, you know, this is the Elizabeth Banks directorial take on this bear that back in, I think, 1985 or the mid-1980s, found a bunch of cocaine from a drug airdrop gone horribly awry. Got into said drugs and OD'd. Now, when they found the bear, I think there were like 3 to 4 grams of like coke in its system. And I read somewhere that like the bear lived for like a minute or like 30 seconds before it died, because that's a lot of coke.
Oh, my gosh.
And actually, it now lives in a mall somewhere in like the Appalachian South. Yeah, yeah.
You mean the stuffed bear?
Yeah, they taxidermy the bear, and you can go see it. I'm pretty sure it's a mall in Tennessee.
Okay, so in real life, but the bear did not go on a rampage and kill all these people.
No, that would have been a really awful movie to see a bear just kind of go belly up, literally, after consuming all of this cocaine. This instead, interestingly, at least to me, is... You know, you're getting all these, like, sweeping shots, right, of, like, the rivers and, like, the mountains and the majesty of Appalachia.
Right.
And I was reminded of a movie like, I don't know, like The Gray, remember that Liam Neeson joint where there's
Arctic?
Yeah, like, it seems like a survival kind of film, mm-hmm. You know, like, the animals are out to get you, but you got to make it back to civilization safely. But this is, like, I don't know, a kind of weirdly self-aware horror flick instead. Because the bear isn't just like an animalistic, I'm a wild animal and I'm a dangerous thing. It's like, it's a murderous bear.
It's a murderous bear.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the jaws of the forest kind of thing.
Can I tell you, first of all, the title is brilliant. Cocaine Bear is a fabulous title for a movie. I mean, it's pretty hard to ignore. And secondly, I love trailers. Many people don't like trailers. They don't like coming attractions. I thought the trailer for this, as Marjorie said, we watched it this morning, is as good as any 2 minutes of any movie. I think it captures the essence of, can you say it, Cocaine Bear. So did you like the damn thing or not?
Yeah, I liked it for a couple of reasons. One, it was like under 2 hours, and I
love
feel
that.
Like every movie I've seen recently is like, can we get close to 3 hours? Like, is there a prestige to 180 minutes?
Which,
and the movie
totally.
Can be 3 hours, but like, does it need to be? So like a 90-ish minute runtime. I did like how... some of the actors, especially like the child actors, in particular Christian Convery, who plays the boy who was in the tree, brings like this like bit of 1980s like backyard kid adventure kind of, you know, flick that I think we have missed for some time. I haven't seen a movie featuring kids outside. I don't know if we still go outside.
That's a good point. No, they
like, do they know how to read a map? I don't know. I was like, oh, yeah. So
I'm dying to see this.
So, but, and I just wonder, in general, the appeal is because it's made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Is it because we love to see these kinds of bear, you know, animals on rampages, or like a shark movie or something like that? What's the thinking about why it's done so well?
I mean,
it's just well done, or it's just the subject matter?
I think it's because it's a product that's telling you exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And if you are into that kind of thing, there's no ambiguity about whether you want to go and actually see it or not. There is no great discussion or debate if this is how you want to spend, you know,
okay.
An evening. or an afternoon. But I also just think it kind of fits in. It's a rated R movie, but I was talking earlier, though, about how this is existing in a space where a lot of the most popular films that I can remember recently are rated PG-13 or kind of like more family, you know, friendly, if you want to say, affairs. But this is like a movie that also isn't taking itself too seriously, and I think it might just kind of fit into this moment of using movies as like a tool for levity, you know, in a way that you escape into whatever James Cameron's world is, like an Avatar or to the cockpit of an
F-16. You just made me think of something. I you would know, and I don't. I was saying what a fan I am of trailers, yet I don't know the answer to this. I've never seen a trailer, I don't think, with people dropping the F-word repeatedly like they do in Cocaine Bear. Is that a new phenomenon, or...
What, was it a Red Band trailer? Did you see it on...
Because if it's red... Official, I think it was it said official trailer, no?
Well, if it's a green trailer, then, you know, that's new. But, no, you can put anything in a trailer if you want, but it has the red band. That's why you see, like, in a theater, it's like this trailer has been approved for all audiences, even if it's a rated R movie, and, like, I don't know, like a Pixar film, which I don't think has ever happened, but theoretically it could.
So you wrote a great piece about the Oscars. You know, part of it said you didn't grow up in a house where you're sitting around talking about the nuances and technicalities of film. So what was your point about the Oscars? Which are this Sunday, right?
Yeah. Which are, no, next Sunday.
Next Sunday,
so the 12th, So the general idea behind this project, or whatever you want to call it, is that last year, the Academy itself decided to shelve 8 awards and present them before the main telecast. This included, I think, things like score, editing, you know.
Best shorts.
Yeah, all the shorts were put out before, which I think is like, it's insulting at its worst. It's a slap in the face to, you know, creators who actually kind of contribute like these essential crafts to the art. And it's patronizing, you know, to the audience that they could assume that we don't care. It's all done, by the way, in the interest of saving time. But if I remember correctly, like the Miami-Buffalo playoff game from last January was like a 4-hour-long affair. The Grammys were almost 4 hours. It's like time. It's a Sunday. Like
what time
are you saving?
Exactly.
Like, you know, like chill. So, but the thing about, you know, not growing up in a household where, you know, movies are really kind of discussed for any, I guess, like artistic, you know, merit or even like entertainment value. Whenever I would watch, you know, award ceremonies like that, you get to certain awards and you're like, I guess this is important. I guess, like, you know, production design is a thing and editing is a thing and cinematography is a thing. But, like, what is it really? Because the telecast doesn't really explain a lot.
Editing is huge.
Yeah, it's exactly. Huge. So what I tried to do is talk to some filmmakers and creators, you know, in the area who could at least explain to me, like, why what they do is so essential. I think the big takeaway was that a lot of, like, good film work is stuff that the audience doesn't actually notice. Not to say that you can't have, like, a very blustering, you know, approach to your, you know, to your makeup, to your sets, to your editing. But by and large, you know, these things kind of slip under the radar because you're creating one seamless product where everything is working in concert with each other to create a very naturalistic viewing experience.
So why did they agree to restore it, the Academy? Why did they agree to restore this? Where was the pressure coming from?
So I can't find exactly why they chose to do it. I do know, if I remember correctly, like, several, like, big names were very upset at that decision. Some people, like Frances McDormand, stayed home.
Because of that?
Really?
I don't know if that's because... I don't know if that's because that's why she stayed home, but I remember reading, it might have been her, that she wanted to be with, like, the makeup crews during, like, the telecast as, like, a solidarity kind of thing.
That's pretty great.
And she didn't, if you remember, she didn't present the award for Best Actor to Will Smith. That was Travolta and Sam Jackson and Uma Thurman.
You know, they're having at the Coolidge Corner this weekend. I think they got the shorts, or they're coming. They run all the short films. They're nominated for Academy Awards, which is pretty neat.
Yo, but actually, so on that, I went to go see Women Talking last weekend, and I walked up to the, like, ticket window, and they were sold out. And I was like, we can sell movie theaters? Like, still? Like, really? And so I asked if I wanted to see the shorts instead, the live-action shorts. Go see them. They're great. And I got a ticket. I walked in about 5 minutes before you know, the lights came down, and that theater was, like, also packed. So, yeah.
Wow.
You know, you make two things. One, your piece that we read makes a compelling case as to how important each of these crafts are, because most of us have no idea what any of these people do. What is cinematography? What is editing? All that sort of stuff. However, in light of the fact that the ratings for all these award shows are in the toilet almost across the board, speaking for myself, while as a principled matter, I totally agree with you, you do important work that is critical to the whole, you should be recognized. The flip side is, I watch for the celebrities. I mean, I really watch for, I love when they pan the audience.
You watch the red carpet.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say I do turn on E! Network, and I'm embarrassed, but it's true. I watch the celebrities. So what do you say to that? Our ratings are atrocious. People want to see the stars. They don't know who Jane Doe is, who's the best cinematographer in America. So why should we lose an audience?
Why should
member?
You care? Yeah, no, that's totally fine. I think it's completely fair to watch an awards ceremony like that for the celebrities, for the red carpet, whatever upside you find is the upside that you get. And, like, I'm not anyone to tell you that that's a stupid thing
you
to do.
You don't watch the red carpet?
No.
What is wrong with you?
But my thing is that, at least in my lived experience, when I look at these awards and I see them, you know, being announced, my thing is, like, I don't know what I'm looking for. Like, when that award for editing comes out, I'm like, what does that mean? If I go see a movie, like, right now, whether I'm, you know, sitting in front of my computer or in front of a theater, in front of a TV, how can I look at this thing, this artifact, through the eyes of an editor? That's why I thought it was valuable to go out and, you know, talk to, you know, a film editor who has a lot of experience in this to explain to me, and then hopefully you can read that and you know, get that as well. And so now when those awards are being, like, meted out, it's like, oh, I can kind of follow along a bit better. Like, that's the value for it.
Okay, so let me explain to you. If you miss the 2 hours of the red carpet, and for those who don't have time to watch 2 hours on E! Network like I do, here's a summary of the 2 hours. You look fabulous. Who made that gown? Whose gown is that? That's essentially what the 2 hours is.
But I get it. You know, you're looking at these gorgeous people and these gorgeous outfits.
Well, you never get to hear them talk. You get to hear them perform. And isn't there a PC that wants
to... Usually when they're talking, whatever. It's very disappointing.
That actually is a very good point. You know who, by the way, I saw an interview. I don't even know why I'm bringing this up. I'm a huge Bryan Cranston fan.
Oh, I love
it. And
him.
I mentioned to you, I went to a ending party with GBH people for...
LBJ?
No. I went to LBJ at the ART that afternoon, where Bryan Cranston is playing LBJ. Yep. I can't remember what it's called. And then, obviously, his show, television show, one of the greatest shows ever, came to an end. And I went to a watch party the same day. And then I heard him interviewed the other day by Chris Wallace. I mean, it's so... You shouldn't watch those interviews. You should just go with the acting. In any case, we're talking to James Bennett the second. Celebrity Jazz Fest. Who, what, and where?
Celebrity Series of Boston Jazz Fest.
Excuse me, thank you very much.
At Epicenter in Southeast. So, yeah, a lot of nouns are going into describing this. So I think it's their second year doing this, but four artists from each night from the 8th to the 11th, so that's next week. Melissa Aldana, you know, tenor saxophonist from Chile who lives in Brooklyn, who just released an album last year, her Blue Note debut, 12 Stars. Who else is playing? Nina Freelon.
She's going to be with us next week, by the way. Isn't she with us someday next week?
I think so.
She's going to, all right, so she'll be here. Hiromi, pianist, and Ambrose Akinmusire, great trumpeter. So you'll have the opportunity to see all four of them playing one night after the other. I think tickets are like $19.
Whoa.
Which for like that caliber is like right on. So
the sax player, what's the name of the song?
Melissa Aldana.
How many, other than Grace Kelly, who's a local kid made good, I should say, how many famous women saxophonists are there around?
Well, like, so what comes to mind, like, immediately for me is Jess Gillum, who I think is Scottish. I'm so sorry for listening to this, Jess Gillum. I've met you. You've played when I was, you know, in the green space in New York when I was still at WQXR, who actually takes, like, a more, if you want to, you know, start throwing around categories and boxes, a more classical approach to the instrument. But she's an utter delight. To look at as well. So, to listen to, I mean, but yeah.
But there aren't many.
No, I think, so here's the thing about, like...
You think of it as a male instrument. There's a gender bias there.
Yeah, there's a huge gender bias. Instruments themselves get gendered quite a bit. You know, some instruments are for girls, some are for boys. Flutes get often gendered as like a more feminine instrument. Mm-hmm. Cellos, interestingly, you know, are gendered as a male instrument because the, you know, polite way of, you know, doing things and playing your instrument is like, you know, legs spread, don't do that, don't play the cello. Pianos, interestingly, in the like late 19th century, I believe, the angel in the home, this idea of like the domestic, you know, kind of creator and caretaker, the piano was seen as the idealized form of that. And so piano became a very acceptable instrument for women to play. And then lastly, I mean, tuba. I think 99% of principal tubists in the United States are male. So instruments do get gendered heavily.
Right. I
know you look to me to decide what you should be writing next. That'd be a really interesting piece, by the way. Yeah. I mean, think about it. I mean, the gendering, is that the appropriate word? You're speaking of nouns, of instruments.
Yeah.
And it's totally...
It's the thing, for real.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
We're talking to James Bennett II. So, maps, cartography. Is that the word? That is the word.
Yeah, that's the word. I like that word.
Something is coming, I believe, the minute the show is over at the Boston Public Library. It's right there?
Back there in the Leventhal Map.
What's going
on? So, hi, Boston Public Library employees, if I'm looking at you and getting this right. There's like a biweekly series, right, where they'll pull up, you know, artifacts and objects from the collection for just like a casual drop-in and viewing. And in this instance, it is a collection of globes and maps and other cartographical curios and wonders created by women.
So, can I ask the same question? Cartography is generally seen as a male kind of thing, you know?
So that's weird, and this might just be, like, you know, the male privilege and perspective that I have speaking, but I've never really given that a whole lot of thought.
Me neither.
Nor have I.
And it's true, and that's kind of what makes these kinds of exhibitions a bit important, right? Because these are things that definitely exist that have stories behind them, and there are things that you should think about. You know, I am black, and I do think it's interesting when I read about, you know, black exploration, which I do think about sometimes, about how, you know, we're not always considered the same conversation as, like, the quote-unquote great, you know, European explorers. Even people that are mapping, you know, the, like, locales that they're familiar with, the neighborhoods in which they live, and how they commit that to visual representation. So I think, you know, those stories are quite important.
Yeah, I went to buy a map, speaking of maps for a second, for a friend a couple of weeks ago, and I just Googled something.
Still buy them.
Well, there is a store on Mass Ave right before Porter Square that is about as fun to go into.
It's a map store?
It's a map store. Of their local maps, their international maps, their subway maps.
For what use were you buying them?
Just as a gift for a friend. And it was fascinating. And I had no interest in it except to buy something. And once I got there, I couldn't leave. It's this little tiny store. They're all divided by the subject matter or the locale. A lot of European stuff. It's really fabulous. I don't remember the name, but just short of Porter Square. You know the name? It is called Ward. Thank you, Jamie. It's called Ward Maps. It's 1735 Massachusetts. It's your favorite store?
It's your favorite store?
Jamie is saying that. It's your favorite store. It's great, right? It's great. What's great about it?
People can't hear him.
All the maps. Thank you very much.
All the maps.
It's great. So
I
check out the
I thought maps were on their last legs because of everybody getting...
No, the physical, you know, I thought that too. But when you touch them, like I bought a map from like 1840 or something of Boston. It's really quite exciting. I mean, it's really, it's exciting. In any case, thank you, Jamie.
That was a beautiful testimony.
Well, I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't have brought it up, but I did, and it was fun.
Okay, so let's get back to the ART. This sounds like a fun time at the ART with kind of this different version of the Canterbury Tales. So this is called The Wife of Williston, if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Yeah, so this is Zadie Smith's interpretation, adaptation of The Wife of Bath's Tale from the Canterbury Tales. Full disclosure, I was not an English major, so I never had to read Chaucer. I also, like, historically have not spent a lot of time in theaters looking at stage plays. So this is both, like, from two sides, a relatively new experience for me. But, yeah, so it sets the, I guess, the action, if you want to call it that, in a 21st century pub in the UK, starring Claire Perkins as Alvita, not Alice or Allison, depending on how you're looking at it in the Chaucerian text. But yeah, you were gonna
Wild Woman.
Yeah, yeah. So
I love it.
So the premise, right, is just like, I guess, in the Chaucer, there's a very, very, very long and developed and fleshed out, you know, prologue, bringing a lot of kind of character to the to Alvita's, you know, being in person. And she's challenging these 21st century double standards and social morals of what it means to be, I guess, like an upright woman. The conflict or the center of debate is the fact that she's been married 5 times, and people across town are like, yo, like, wow, that's too many. And then she has these very, you know, very sharp, very witty, very, like, metrically rhythmic responses and retorts. And what's interesting is that that's pretty much the way the prologue is set up in Chaucer 2. And so on one hand, you're like, oh, it's really cool seeing how these themes and ideas are explored, you know, some, you know, 700 years ago. But then you're like, well, this is kind of depressing that we're still having, like, the same conversation over and over again. But again, I was really drawn in by the language and the rhythm therein. It was a wonderful time.
Why do you, for an arts and culture guy, you said when you're introducing that discussion, you don't see a lot of stage productions. Why?
So that was for transparency.
I know we appreciate it, but why is that?
Yeah. So historically, I guess my work has been attuned a lot to, like, music and food are kind of like really big ones.
Can't do everything,
Jim. Stuff like that. And so my theater, I guess, like, exploits and explorations are kind of, like, out of that sphere. Mm-hmm. And, like, theater, let's be real, it's expensive, man.
Very expensive.
Like, it is not cheap. And so, if I'm going to be, you know, covering theater in some way, if you want to call it that, like, that's a lot of times an out-of-pocket expense and for my own personal edification. And mm-hmm. It's like, yo, things are expensive.
But you know what is neat? And I've been to the ART a couple of times, is how close you are. You're not up in the third balcony looking down. You need binoculars to see the people on the stage. You feel like you're really part of it, which is...
It's like eye level.
Yeah.
It's really intimate in a way, yeah.
It is really intimate. And I think that's one of its...
I'm with you.
...great selling points.
So, James, how do people get the drop? What do they do?
Oh, you go to gbh.org/thedrop. I think it's pretty simple. gbh.org/news/thedrop. And you'll see the, you know, a list of things to check out. Before we break, though, I do want to issue an on-air correction that Jess Gillum is not, in fact, she's from Cumbria, which is famously not in Scotland.
Oh,
okay.
So, yeah.
How'd you discover that in the last 15 minutes?
He looked at his computer.
What's really nuts is that there's a computer right in front of me,
yeah.
And the internet is really fast now.
It is amazing.
But, yeah, still an awesome performer, yes. And a great saxophonist. Well, and I was like,
I spent half my time issuing on-air corrections.
That's why our show's 3 hours.
Also, before we break, I also wanted to address, too, this idea that because instruments can be gendered, you're just kind of like, oh, they're not a lot of, like, blank saxophone or blank, you know, instrumentalists. Listen to someone's saxophonist. Just look. You know, you can dig and you can.
Any more clarifications or corrections you want to make before you go or no?
No.
That's it.
That's all.
James Bennett II, we love you. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for being here.
gbhnews.org/news/thedrop. Did I get it right?
Oh, yeah, you did.
I did. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank
We've
you,
been
James.
Speaking with GBH arts and culture reporter James Bennett II. You can check out his monthly series, Jim was just talking about it, The Drop, by going to gbhnews.org. So I guess you can actually just go to gbhnews.org and see The Drop there too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. After a quick break, we're going to be joined by Vincent Pastore, best known for his 2-season stint as Big Pussy on The Sopranos. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
trusted, local news. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR, what matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. She's Marjorie Egan. I am Jim Browdy. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News. You might recognize our next Zoom guest as the slimy, double-timing gangster, Big Pussy on HBO's The Sopranos, either the first or second greatest show of all time, depending on how I feel. Here's a little sound to jog your memory. It's from the moment he got his due for ratting on Tony and the gang in the final episode of season two.
On the face, okay? Give me that. Huh? Keep my eyes?
You were like a brother to me. To all of us.
I feel like I can't stand. Is that okay, Tony? Did I sit?
I remember that like it was yesterday. Vincent Pastore is the man who brought Big Pussy to life, and next weekend he'll be doing a Q&A with two other major Sopranos players, Steve Sciarippa, Bobby Bacala, and Michael Imperioli, Christopher, and now you've also seen him in White Lotus Season 2 at the Box Center Schubert Theater. For tickets, you go to boxcenter.org. Vincent, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
I really love the fact that you introduced me as slimy.
Yeah, I meant that in a loving way, actually.
I think
I've been called a lot of things in my career, you know, because I played wrestling, but I've never been called slimy.
Not very nice of him. Not very nice of him. I will not do that. I just want to tell you that right now.
It's a bad start. It's a bad start.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, The Sopranos has been off the air for quite some time now, but the fact that people still want to come and spend the evening asking you guys questions, it's really something.
Huh? Yes, off the air. There are people who have seen it for the first time now.
That's true. Yep.
On all these streamlines and stuff, HBO streaming, they have the access to the CDs, clips are on YouTube. You know, I've been doing a lot of lectures to students. I just gave one up to a high school in Westchester County, and the kid asked me, this one kid asked me, what's it like playing a rap? And, you know, you get an 18-year-old, 17-year-old kid say, what's it like playing a rap? It's like, okay, I said, and see, they didn't see season two yet.
Yeah. Well, explain to people, by the way, what was your rat deed that got you dead?
Me?
Yeah.
Pussy?
Yeah.
He was there on coke. And season three was a flashback.
Hey, Vincent, we have to just hold this for one second. This connection is atrocious, and I'm worried people can't hear Vincent. Vincent, sit tight for about 30 seconds. We're going to try to make a better connection with you. Have you rewatched, while we're waiting, I've rewatched the whole thing,
seasons. But I'm going to, because I've rewatched part of it, but not the whole thing.
Well, you know, I said at the top, it's either, in my opinion, the first or second greatest show ever. The Wire is the other one, that, depending on the day, how I feel. It is just brilliant. And it isn't the mob's... It's an American family. It is the best storytelling about an American family that I think I've ever seen in my life.
It was about the children's relationship with Tony, the soprano. It was about the marriage between him and Carmela. It was about the mafia. It was about all these things. And it was kind of a decline of America kind of thing, too, I thought, where it was kind of portraying how that was one of the big themes, right? The mob when it was supposed to be set, when was it set, the 1990s or 2000s or something
like that? I
think
it was a contemporary, but
I don't know. It wasn't the same as the mob years ago.
So are we doing better here?
Back yet?
Vince, are you there or no? Oh, he's getting him on the phone. Okay, we'll hold that for a...
And you know what we can talk about while we're waiting? The ending?
Yeah, I know. How did you feel about the ending?
At the time I saw it, I was very disappointed. But the further away I've come from
exactly
the ending,
the
I thought it was absolutely brilliant. We have a little sound from the ending, don't we?
Sure, play it.
Yeah. Let's play. This is should I set the scene?
Sure.
The whole family is, not the whole family because...
Three out of four.
The daughter's out parking the
Meadow.
Car, and Meadow keeps backing into the curb, and she's trying to back the car. But Carmela, Tony, and the son, AJ, are all sitting in this diner, and the feeling is very ominous because you see a guy that looks very suspicious walking into the men's room. You see somebody else that walks by them. So you have a feeling that something very bad is about to happen. And here's the sound.
It was work today.
All I'm doing is getting coffee and placing English phone calls.
You may not realize it, but you are making contacts.
It's an entry-level job. Buck up. Focus on the good times.
Don't be sarcastic.
Isn't that what you said one time? Try and remember the times that were good?
I did?
Yeah.
Well, sure, I guess.
Do you remember how many people thought their TVs had broken or it just stopped.
It
was a black screen.
And it went to black. Yeah. And you didn't know. Does Tony get shot? Does he not get shot? And I think we should ask Big Pussy what the consensus is if we can get him back.
Well, he
here.
Was a viewer at that stage, too, which gives him an even more interesting perspective. We're attempting to solve the technical problems with Vincent Pastore, who played Big Pussy. And we are close, I'm just told, by one of my colleagues. And we should say, what is the date on which they are all at the – do we have the date on that? When they're at boxcenter.org? We should get the date. I think it would be helpful. We'll do that in a second. What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite show?
A television show?
That's correct.
That was one of the great ones of all time. Well, I didn't like Breaking Bad as much as you did, because every time I turned on Breaking Bad, someone was getting their head shot off, and I really couldn't take that.
A lot of head shot off.
I just love White Lotus. I just watched season one and season
two.
I thought that was absolutely
with Michael from The Sopranos in season two.
And
by the way, it's March 11th at the Box Center. I should have said that when we introduced Vincent a couple of minutes ago.
Do you?
Besides, do I what?
I know you love Breaking Bad.
The Wire is brilliant.
Oh, The Wire. I forgot about The Wire.
Totally
the
brilliant.
Wire is great. It's tough to watch in a lot of the sections, but it's a really great thing about drug life and drug dealing in the inner city.
Well, every season was a different thing. Journalism, unions, police. Yeah, it was brilliantly constructed and another great show.
As we just were talking about with Vincent Pastore, you can see all these things. Again, I think The Sopranos is on HBO, isn't it? I think so.
Jamie is saying, yes, it is. March 11th, and again, you can get tickets because it sounds like this may not work out here. Boxcenter.org. Could someone give us a sign if this is not going to be a reconnect thing?
We got him back. Okay, great.
Well, why don't I reintroduce Vincent as that slimy, double-timing gangster, Big Pussy. Is that okay with you, Vincent, or what?
I don't think so.
You can call me you want, but don't call me late for dinner.
Ba-dum-bum. Thank you very much, sir.
You know, I also read, Vincent, that for people that are aspiring actors, I mean, you had another career, right? Before you, I think you were 42 when you began being an actor.
Yeah,
Tell us about that.
I ran nightclubs for about 20 years in my hometown, New Rochelle, New York. And then I got into acting when I was 42.
And how'd that happen?
Well, I lost the bar. I wrote a play. I lost the bar, and I was like drifting around. And then I was running another bar, and... a couple of guys from the neighborhood who are said that I should go after acting. It was Kevin and Matt Dillon.
Ooh.
So Kevin set me up with an appointment downtown. And the first time I went down there, I fell on my face. but then it was ironic. And then years later, I made a movie with Maddie. And, you know, I'm still good friends with Kevin, and, you know, it's ironic.
But didn't you get a word from the wise at one of your first meetings about the future of the part you'd be playing?
That was in class.
Yeah, what'd they say?
My first acting teacher is Michael Beckett. He's still down there at HB Studios.
Yeah.
Where I teach now. It's full circle. And he said, yeah, Vinny, you're always going to be playing wise guys. And he put his finger to his nose, and, you know, I said, yeah, who cares? You know, but... you know, that's not what we do on the side. Like, I'm directing a play now with Maureen Van Zandt and Bobby Fornaro.
Oh, nice.
I have a reading on Monday, which I can't talk about. It means Steve Sciarippa, some big people.
Bobby
Bagala. You know, And I'm an actor, and that's what I do. That's what I've been doing since I was 42 years old.
We love when people bring up things they can't talk about, Vince. We love that particularly.
What?
I said we love when people bring up things that they can't talk about. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can't talk about it.
I know what you mean. I can't talk about it either then. So when you get a script, David, who sends the scripts to you? David Chase himself, whoever sends the script. When you read...
David Chase hasn't sent me a script in 20 years.
Okay, I know, but I'm talking about on The Sopranos. When you find out that it's your last episode in maybe the greatest television show, as I said, or the second, one, first or second of all time, what's that feel like when you know your character is about to die?
Find out was your last episode.
What's that?
I don't understand the question.
When you get a script and you realize that's the last episode because you're going to be dead in the episode.
Oh, well, we knew that was coming.
And that was okay?
What am I going to do? Say I don't want to do it? Go home?
I guess you probably wouldn't do that.
So what? When you do these Q&A things of Vincent Pastore, what are the big questions? What does everybody want
to know? Well, we're not doing really a Q&A. We've been running around with this show for years now. It's a show. It's called Comedy and Conversations with Sopranos, and it's hosted by Joey Cola. Joey comes out, and he does 10 minutes of stand-up, and then he interviews us.
Okay.
And then we do a Q&A. So it's basically a pretty tight show. We've been doing it, and it's funny. And sometimes it gets a little out of hand, depending on where we are.
Oh, yeah?
Right? Yeah.
And what happens when it gets out of hand?
No, it's just between us up on stage.
Oh, okay. Might be a little fisticuffs.
It's funny. It gets funny. One of the questions, I guess I can say this to you.
Yeah. Sure.
Marijuana is legal now.
It is.
One of the questions Sharippa asked me, he says, didn't you get fired from The Sopranos because you were a pothead? That's what he says to me on stage.
And were you?
I said, everybody was smoking. It was a particular night with Springsteen. And my answer is, everybody was smoking pot that night.
That's not really a direct answer, though. You know what I mean?
Good for you. Good for you.
Hey, Vincent, when you...
I never got fired from The Sopranos.
He was killed. He was whacked.
My character became what you almost like a pawn in theater, where by getting rid of me, the show blew up.
Right.
I would vouch for that. You know, we're talking to Vincent Pastore.
David had said years later he regretted it. He said it to me, and he said it to Mike. He said it on the podcast.
What?
He regretted it, but it was the move to make then. They were only in their second season. They didn't know they were going to have 7 seasons.
So when you do a role like that and all of America is watching, because that was the time when there were not 400 stations and The Sopranos was it, do you worry about getting typecast? And the reason I ask you that question is I'm watching season 2.
I've been typecast. I've been typecasted since I went downtown.
I know.
My first movie was State of Grace, The Godfather, Men of Respect, Law and Order. I was playing gangsters. I was typecasted from the minute I went into the business.
Yeah, but I don't even mean typecast as a wise guy. I mean even more narrowly, typecast as Big Pussy. Because I'm watching White Lotus season 2 the other night, and Michael Imperioli, as you know, is in there. And there wasn't a minute when I'm not thinking Christopher as good as he was.
That's because you got that locked in. And
yeah.
It's like, but it's not true.
What does that mean?
That's the way you look at it.
That is exactly right.
That's not the way HBO looked at it. They would have never gave him the job.
They didn't hire
Christopher Molisante. They hired Michael Imperioli. He's an actor.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, but Jim does have a point. They kept thinking about the night he sat in the dog. That was very upsetting.
One of the greatest
when he killed the dog,
ever.
Don't you think? I mean, Vincent, that was a tough scene.
Sat
poor
on the
dog.
Pool.
We talk about that on stage.
You do?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a funny show.
I heard that. So, Vincent Pastore, one last thing. So, is there a question that is the most common? I'm assuming, even though you weren't in the show at the end, everybody asks about the ending. Other than the ending, what's the most common question the three of you get from the audience?
They ask us a lot of questions about our relationship with Jimmy.
And what was your relationship with James
Gandolfini? Well, I love Jimmy. We all love Jimmy. I would have never been able to do the work I did on that show without Jimmy's help. And that's something else I talk about on stage.
Well, talk to us about it a little bit.
Well, then what's the sense of coming to the show?
God, it's so thick.
Well, okay. Well, just give us a tiny hint.
Tiny, and then we'll let you go.
Just
don't worry.
Piece.
Well, Jimmy and I had a friendship, and it was a friendship pre-Sopranos because, you know, we were studying with the same people, and I would be on a movie. He would be, like, the lead, and I'd be an extra, like, Night Falls in Manhattan. Jimmy had a lead. I was a day player. I knew Jimmy, and when I got the role, it was like I already had that connection with Jimmy, and Tony Sirico was like my best friend, and Michael was like my nephew. Michael used to come into my nightclub when he was 13 years old. I mean, we knew each other.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't like David had a problem. I got to bring these guys together. You know, we already knew each other and we already worked with each other. If you look at Mickey Blue Eyes, everybody that's in Sopranos is a Mickey Blue Eyes.
So true. March 11th, what's the website to get the tickets again, Marjorie?
The website is boxcenter.org. For tickets, you go to boxcenter.org to get the tickets. And sorry about the screw up with the Zoom, but we're really thankful you took the time to be with us.
No, that's all right. I enjoyed talking to you this way. Tom Big Pussy sent you for tickets.
Absolutely.
If he does, we'll take him. Hey, thanks so much, Vincent. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Congratulations on your great career.
Yeah,
I don't get
that because I teach on Zoom.
Okay. Very good.
I teach on Zoom. I got 18 students, so I don't understand why there was a screw-up.
Exactly.
Okay, bye. Love you. Goodbye.
I don't know what the question was, but thank you for the answer. We appreciate it.
Okay, we've been speaking
Vincent
with Vincent
Pastore.
Yes, who's taking part in the Sopranos event.
Q&A.
Yes. Well, it's
whatever
an interview,
it is.
Whatever it is.
Exactly.
With Michael Imperioli, Steve Sciarrapa, next Saturday, the 11th, at the Bach Center Schubert Theater. And for tickets, as I said before, you go to boxcenter.org.
No.
Okay. A lot of people have been texting me about when this is going to happen. Well, it's happening right now.
I think this segment might go a little bit better. That's what I think.
Live Music Friday. Well, you know, they can't all be perfect.
No, they can't all be perfect.
We're celebrating the fact that St. Patrick's Day is just around the corner. We're going to hear some of the music from the Celtic Sojourns. Brian and Lindsay O'Donovan will be here, plus players from this year's St. Patrick's Day Celtic Sojourn. You're listening to Boston Public Radio live from the Boston Public Library. We are streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News. We're joined now by Brian and Lindsay O'Donovan ahead of a St. Patrick's Day Celtic Sojourn. That's March 15th through 19th. More information is available at gbh.org or CelticSojournLive.com. In a few moments, we'll hear some wonderful music. We heard a preview before and get to talk with Keith Murphy and Katie McNally. But first, the legendary Brian O'Donovan and Lindsay O'Donovan. Great to see you both.
Thank you, Jim. So I just want to tell you, I think I've got a dozen texts. If I've gotten one, I was just telling Lindsay, people saying, when are they on? When are they on? When are they on? Well, they're here. They are here right now.
Great.
Brian, what's happening? Is this the Celtic Sojourn? It's going to happen in just a few days. What's going to happen?
It is. It's probably our 25th iteration of it, Marjorie. So largely we have developed this to provide some alternatives for St. Patrick's Day itself, and it's a series of concerts that we're really looking forward to.
Where are they, Lindsay? They're in a bunch of venues, right?
Yes, they are. We're really happy to be back at the Shaylin Lou in Rockport. Mm-hmm. And then,
have you been there, by the way?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that question, because I promise you I'm going to go, I have not gotten there yet. That's the one I'm targeting.
Yeah, but that's
actually
on Wednesday night, right? So that's what I'm talking for school night, but that's the one with the beautiful picture window looking out over
the open
harbor. It's absolutely gorgeous.
But where else,
up there,
Lindsay?
We're going to be the next night in a beautiful new venue out in Groton, Mass. I can't remember the name of it.
It's just simply called the Groton Performing Arts Center.
It's a good enough
name.
It
truly is amazing, Jim. If you haven't seen this, you've got to make a trip, especially. It's like Tanglewood moved east.
And where else, Lindsay?
And on Friday, we actually have St. Patrick's Day itself off, because this guy here is actually known for making a really good Irish coffee. So
I can't imagine that.
You can just stop by the house. Saturday, we have two shows at Sanders Theater, 3 and 7:30.
One of the great venues right here in the Boston area.
That one I've been to.
Yes.
That's amazing.
I'll be there
about five
again.
Blocks from my house.
And we finish up on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening at 5 at the Cabot Theater in Beverly.
You know, which is another wonderful venue,
beautiful.
By the way. Especially, they've redone it. It's gorgeous. I know Brian is so sick of me telling the exact same story every time he's on, but I'm going to say it. I had no interest in Celtic music. And then I started listening to the radio show. That changed. I had less than no interest in Celtic dance. And I finally came to a Celtic Christmas show. Totally changed my perspective and life. And let me just tell you, for those who have not been to any of these things, this is a treat extraordinary. Brian, explain, for people who just think it's one thing, it's music performing, it's a whole panoply of things. Explain what a typical show is like, what this show is like.
Well, what we decided, Lindsay and I, many years ago, is to imitate or replicate what we've got in our own house over the years and developed over the years. You know, St. Patrick's Day is one of those holidays that is kind of bifurcated. You either hate it or you love it, or you get out of town. Tell a little bit about that, Lindsay. We consciously made an effort to put on a gathering at our house.
We used to have a gathering every year at our house on St. Patrick's Day with friends and neighbors, and it would be a day where, to talk about Irish dance, our kids would be doing Irish dance, and we'd be driving around to nursing homes, and it was kind of a real homey day.
Mm-hmm.
And people would sit around the table and tell a story or a poem and sing a song. And then we just kind of felt that the city really needed an alternative to the bar scene, which is a wonderful scene and it's a lot of fun. But they needed an alternative for people that wanted to really go to a nice kind of a concert.
Or perhaps an alternative to the St. Patrick's Day Parade, which was notorious for excesses involving the bar scene over there on Broadway.
But
right?
I guess the point, there's storytelling. There are musical performances, both instrumental and vocal. And there is brilliant dancing. I mean, it's like, I don't know if you use, is it a variety show like a pejorative term now? But it is a variety show.
It absolutely is a variety show. I'm proud of that. I grew up with variety shows, Jim, and I love them. And it's like, if you don't like something, wait a minute, because it's going to change. And we have established that largely because of the artists that we bring, and you're going to hear a couple of those artists very, very soon. But there is so much talent out there in Irish traditional music, and of course it crosses over easily into Appalachian music, into Quebecois music, into Scottish music, again, as you're going to hear in just a little while.
You know, we get texts about you all the time. I assume most people listening know you're dealing with a serious health issue. Mm. What does this do for your spirits when we get closer to moments like that? Your wife is going like two thumbs up.
Yeah.
What does it do to you, for you?
It really improves my spirits all around. And yes, and thanks to you and thanks to other articles that are out there, people know that I'm going through a treatment for cancer. Wouldn't wish it on anybody, but it is what it is. And presenting live music and being on stage, reading poetry and bringing sing-alongs to a sold-out audience is something that really, really ups my spirits dramatically.
You know, I can't ask Brian this question, Lindsay, because he'll be too humble to say it. There is almost not a group of local musicians who we have on the show or we encounter who don't, when we say, how'd you get your start? How'd you get to this club? How'd you get... Almost always there's a Brian O'Donovan moment. I mean, he really has. You don't have to listen to this, talking to your wife. He has done as much for the local music scene, live performances, as practically anybody on the planet, no?
Yes, he has, and he's been very involved in other genres of music. And I think basically when Brian sees a young musician of pretty much playing anything that needs some sort of a help, or he'll turn them, you know, towards somebody at NEC. In fact, Lily Henley, who was one of our stars at Christmas, that did the beautiful Sephardic music, was not in the Irish tradition at all at that time. And Brian took her under his wing and introduced her to people at NEC. And then here we have her as one of our stars at Christmas Celtic. And Katie McNally's been playing in our kitchen for years since she was in
middle
school.
We're going to hear her in a second. Can I tell you one other thing? I mean, when people ask Marjorie and me at events, like, what's your favorite episode? What's your favorite segment? We mentioned a few. You know what's always in this? I don't even know if you heard it, Lindsay. One St. Patrick's Day, we had Tim Brennan, who obviously is with the Dropkicks, a local guy.
Great musician.
Playing his guitar brilliantly, and Brian singing. And it was as great a 22 minutes. Am I right or am I right there, Marjorie?
It was great.
It was totally great.
Yeah.
So what are we going to hear from our performers in the next couple of minutes here?
Well, we've got two performers here who have been with us for many different events. Keith Murphy, in fact, is our music director for this year. And he is steeped in traditional Irish music, traditional English music, traditional Scottish music. And he is from the wonderful maritime province of Newfoundland, even though he now makes his home in Brattleboro, Vermont. Again, as Lindsay talked about here, encouraging younger musicians is really what traditional Celtic music is about. And Katie McNally has really surprised us all over the years. She has just become a really top-notch musician, I believe. Katie, we're going to hear some Scottish music on fiddle.
Okay. A song first. What's the name of the song? Your mic isn't on yet. What's the name of the song?
It's called
Heave Away Me Johnny. Heave Away Me Johnny's. Let's hear it. Here's Katie and Keith.
As I walk out one summer's morn down by the salt house docks, heave away me Johnny's. Heave away me, being an immigrant Irish boy conversing with Tapscott, and away me bully boys. We're all bound to go. Good morning, Mr. Tapscott, sir. Good morning, sir, says me. Heave away me Johnny's. Heave away. It's have you got any packet ships bound for America? And away me bully boys. We're all bound to go. Oh yes, I've got some packet ships. I have got one or two. Heave away me Johnny's. Heave away. I've got the Jimmy Walker and I've got the Kangaroo. And away me bully boys, we're all bound to go. St. James, heave away me Johnny's, heave away. A dirty northwest wind come up and blew us back again. And away me bully boys, we're all bound to go. So we snugged her up and laid her to with reef made topsail set. Heave away me Johnny's, heave away. I tell you boys, it was no joke on our bunks and clothes was wet. Boys, we're all bound to go. It cleared up fine at break of day, and we set sail once more. Heave away, me Johnnies, heave away. And every immigrant shore was glad to reach America's shore. And away, me bully boys, we're all bound to go. And away, me bully boys, we're all bound to go.
And Katie McNally, are we going to talk to them over there?
No, they're joining us. Yeah.
They're going to come over here. So our producer just told us that Brian met Katie when she was 12 years old and introduced her to Celtic music way back then. We just kind of mosey on over to Donovan House, or how'd this happen?
Yeah, I was playing Scottish and Irish music in Boston, and my friend Amanda... and her mom, I guess it was just after some show, like at Club Passim, they were like, oh, there's a party at Theo Donovan's house. And I was like, who? And my mom was like, is it cool if we go over there? And they were like, yeah. And then we went over, and the house was just, like, bursting with musicians. And it's just always been a a wonderful place to hang out and meet people and play music.
Well, you know, Keith, I was at the weekend a couple of weeks ago. I went to the show in Cambridge where they gave Brian a big award, and everybody there was talking about his importance to the growth of Celtic music in Boston. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, you were just talking about, you know, the way that Brian is with musicians and just how incredibly supportive he is. And, of course, he also has the radio show. And, you know, he's someone who is just, whose knowledge of the music is so deep. And I think, you know, he just does a great job in all of these platforms that he's had over the years of kind of bringing, like, you know, a very knowledgeable presentation of Irish music and culture and poetry to the public. I mean, I think that's been huge.
So you're the music director. Let's open all the closed closets. What's it like to work with Brian? I mean, I always worry when somebody is as nice as Brian is on the surface, I'm always convinced there's something dark underneath there. So what's it like working for the last 12 years with this guy?
Well, I feel like I'm like a pussy pumping cereal. I could get whacked after the show if I tell the whole story here. No, Brian, as I say, you know, Brian, he's so aware of what's going on in the scene. He always brings, I sometimes think of my role as, I'm sort of the cook. Mm. Brian does all the shopping, and he goes to the market. He gets all the best ingredients. Mm-hmm. He puts them on the table, and then I get to think of, you know, what dishes to make.
And he's also one of the greatest storytellers ever. When he's sitting in that chair, that soft chair of his on the stage, you're telling a story. You know, one of the things I love most about all these Celtic events that Brian oversees there, Katie, is the cross-pollination of the artists. I don't know if you're doing it this thing, but you'll hear a performance like from you, for example, and then 10 minutes later, you'll be back with another set of players. And it really creates a fabulous feel. Yes?
Yeah, it's awesome. I mostly play Scottish and Cape Breton music. Mm-hmm. But playing on Brian's shows, I get the opportunity to play with fantastic Irish musicians, Spanish musicians, Quebecois musicians, this like whole gamut of the Celtic world.
Is it as much fun as it appears? Seriously,
yeah,
it is.
Totally.
Yeah. Even if it's outside your general comfort zone kind of thing?
Yeah, it's all, you know, like it's all, they're all the tunes are cousins. We all, we're like, oh, you know this one, and you're like, well, we call it this, and someone else is like, no, we call it that. And
I think, in fact, that's in a way, that's like kind of a secret of the show, that the musicians are having a lot of fun, mm-hmm. that they're doing these collaborations that they don't normally do. They're not just kind of getting up and doing the show that they always do. They're playing in different combinations, maybe playing a little bit outside their comfort zone. And I think that creates like a lot of excitement and enthusiasm on stage, and that gets passed on to the audience.
It's felt by the audience.
Keith, Brian mentioned you're from Newfoundland, and you were just talking, Katie, about the Cape Breton. So how, I think when we think of Celtic music, we think of Ireland. But there's this whole other tradition, right? So how did that happen? Are these Irish people that moved to Newfoundland, or is it something else?
Newfoundland to you,
excuse me.
Well done, Jim.
Thank you. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, so, you know, Newfoundland was a large Irish population that immigrated to Newfoundland. And so that has had, like, a big impact on the music and the culture of Newfoundland. But in all of these instances, whenever any of these immigrant groups moved to wherever,
yep.
Eastern Canada, Appalachia, they brought those traditions, and then they morphed kind of in unique ways in each of these places for a variety of reasons, possibly because of what they were adjacent to culturally and so on. So in each of these places, like Newfoundland, Cape Breton, they carried on the traditions of the places where the people came from, but in their own distinct ways.
So, Katie, a few years ago, Brian helped me. I was taking my kids over to Ireland, and he told me which bars to go to. And I did not, or music bar venues, I should say, not just to drink.
We know what your priorities are.
Yeah, that's right, the music. And what I was so amazed at is you're there Thursday night at some pub, and all these musicians come in and spontaneously perform. I mean, that's different.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think the reason I'm drawn to traditional music is because it's so warm and welcoming and intergenerational and, like, come on in. That's the idea. The
exactly.
Same. Yeah.
So you're doing a solo deal now, are you not? For us, I mean.
Yeah, I'm going to
What are you doing?
I'm going to be playing some tunes from Cape Breton Island in Nova Scotia. older Scottish tunes, Miss Lyle's Strathspeyan Reel, and then we'll go into a tune called Trip to Windsor.
So you want to mosey on over there?
Sure thing.
No, you're staying here. Are you playing with her?
I'm going to play with her.
Oh, I didn't know that. Great. So Keith and Katie are going to play for you yet again. Have you always been into this? I was just making my admission with Brian, like I always do, that I'm late to the fair. Have you always been into the Celtic music?
Well, you know, with my grandparents being from Ireland, I really should have been in it right from the start, right?
No, but were you? But it doesn't mean you'd like it. It could be forced.
I do.
You know something?
You go and you hear it play and you think, this is what my grandparents heard growing up. This is what my great-grandparents heard growing up. So there's kind of a nostalgia thing going on. You know what I mean?
So here they are yet again, Keith Murphy and Katie McNally.
That was fantastic. I want you to know you have a lot of fans. I've been getting texts all afternoon from people that are huge fans of Brian O'Donovan and his wife, Lindsay, and huge friends of the Celtic music show on Saturday afternoons, 3 to 6, and of the Sojourns of Christmas and the Celtic celebration for St. Patrick's Day. So thank you very much for coming in. We really appreciate it. Keith Murphy, Katie McNally, they'll be performing St. Patrick's Day, Celtic Sojourn, March 15th through March 19th. For more information, available at gbh.org or CelticSojournLive.com. And thank you for Brian O'Donovan and Lindsay for coming in, too. So after a quick break, we all know how expensive housing in Boston is. But for just $2,500 a month, all food and liquor at lunchtime included, would you pack your bags and live permanently on a cruise ship? At that price, would you even mind getting the norovirus? We'll open the phone and text lines next for an opportunity to spend 3 years, $2,500 a month, all the food you can eat on a cruise ship. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming at youtube.com, GBH News, and facebook.com/GBH News.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews and at facebook.com/GBHnews. This is an amazing story. We're closing things out with a proposal. $30,000 a year, all your meals and drinks accounted for, nightly entertainment, free gym membership, all your standard living costs. It covers your Wi-Fi, your water, your heating, paid for all while sailing around the world.
That's right.
$30,000 annually for a tiny room, but still, it's only $2,500 a month, around the average cost of a studio apartment in Boston. That's not even taking into account the money you're saving on everything else in your life. CNN reports that something called Life at Sea Cruises just opened bookings, and they're planning to set sail on November 1st this year. Still have time to get your passport, vaccines, and finances in order. You have to commit to 3 years of this, by the way. The number is 877-301-8970 to call or text. Would you consider ditching your place on solid land if it turned out it was cheaper and more fun to live on a cruise ship? They go to 375 ports over this period of time.
All over the world.
Yeah, and especially the other beautiful thing they provide, when you eat enough cruise line buffet food to give yourself a heart attack, you can get treated for free because they have free medical care also on the boats. The number is 877-301-8970.
Now, I have two corrections.
What is it?
They only give you the free liquor at dinner, so you can't drink all day long. It's only at dinner.
Most of us only drink at dinner, Margaret.
Well, you do, but you're on a cruise. Some people are drinking all day long.
Okay,
you
know then you can pay for your drink and lunch.
All day long. And two couples, you could buy a cabin and you could divide it between them. So you could have one couple go for like a year and a half and the other couple go for another year and a half. They can do that too. So that's okay. And $30,000 only gets you the inside room, which is kind of small.
But it's not much more to get a room where you can see the water. It's $7,000 or $8,000 more.
It's a little bit more, so you can have the room that sees the water. Then you can also get a balcony suite, but they're much more expensive.
So
they're like $100,000.
Can we get into the merits of this thing? You have heard me say on this radio show, if I had a choice between going on a cruise and being waterboarded, I would say, give me the waterboarding. Having said that,
you've never been on a cruise.
Well, that's exactly right, and
exactly.
I never intend to be until I heard about this thing. Let me get on the list. Free Wi-Fi. No, you don't pay for utilities. You don't pay for medical care. You don't pay for entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
You don't pay for liquor at dinner.
Yeah.
By the way, on a cruise, one thing I do know about cruises,
well,
even though I've taken one, all you can eat at every single meal.
And the entertainment they have
that's
at night is almost as good as going to a Broadway show. I would say it is as good as going to a Broadway show. They have great singers, great dancers, great shows every single night. Every single night.
So let me just say this. If you are one, it seems to me, if you're one of two kinds of people, you're either retired and you want to see the world for a fairly affordable price, or you're a kid. You're 20-something.
Remote worker.
I was going to say remote work, but in addition to remote work, you say, I'm not really sure what I want to do now.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do remote work exactly from wherever. They spend Christmas, I think, in Brazil, New Year's Eve in Argentina or something like that. I mean, it's a pretty exciting, totally inexpensive, as these kinds of things go, experience. So we want to know if this would lure any of you. What's your reaction? It's $30,000. It's a small room, 130 square feet, but you get everything included. Including seeing the world. 877-301-8970.
We're getting some of the pictures from our staff here. The biggest room is 200 square feet with 110 square foot balcony. But the balcony, the views in these bigger rooms are pretty good.
You're not spending time in your room if you're on a cruise.
Have a whole a business center complete with meeting rooms and offices and library and lounge if you want to go and work there. Or you can also work out on the deck of the ship if you're in a nice, warm climate. I don't know. I could see, as you said, if you're retired, and this is a pretty inexpensive, $30,000 is really inexpensive for the everything included. Or if you're like a young kid that's trying to decide what to do with the rest of their life, I can see that the appeal of this. Because you look at how much the price of an average studio apartment in Boston this year, $2,200, according to WCVB. Now, that does not include, in many cases, your utilities. It certainly doesn't include your groceries, which cost the average, CBS says, about $355 every single month for groceries. So, you know, then your health insurance and Wi-Fi, all these things, and your laundry.
It's like a savings kind of deal.
It's kind of a savings.
And it's also
kind of
like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We want to know if you would entertain this concept. And by the way, I didn't know you could divide it up. So you obviously don't want to commit 3 years, even if you're a retiree. You do a year, a friend of yours does a year, and yeah. a third friend of yours does another.
I don't know if you can do it three ways. You can do it two ways.
Whatever. 877-301-8970. And by the way, in addition to talking about this kind of special deal, if anybody would like to try to persuade me that my bias against cruises is ill-founded,
yep.
and I would have the time of my life, you are free to entertain your calls.
I think you cannot knock it, Jim, till you've tried it.
You've never been on a cruise? What
yes,
do you know?
I have.
Where'd you go on a cruise?
I went on a cruise to the Bahamas with my kids.
How long did that take, like a day?
No, it was like 5 days. We went to that, whatever that big thing is, the Bahamas, the city of Atlantis or something whatever. Like that in the Bahamas. The problem for me in the cruise ship, it takes you forever when they're big to get on and forever to get off. That's the problem.
Don't you get stuck like a dinner with a bunch of a-holes? You don't
no,
even know?
No, we sat at the table. The four of us were at the same table.
You had your own
every
table?
Single night. Yes, every
oh.
single night. You get dressed up. You get to know your wait staff. You have the same person every night.
So why aren't you doing more cruises? What's your problem?
Well, I wasn't that crazy about it. Let's put it
What'd
that
way. What'd you like the least?
The size of the cruise ships. They're massive.
Big. Well, some
they're,
of them are.
They're
we
massive.
Don't have big,
so. And if you want to go somewhere, like they have these beaches that they own, or you mm-hmm. stop in different ports. It is long lines getting on the boat, long lines getting off the boat.
I have
like
to say,
that.
The thing that's appealing to me, and then we'll get to your phone calls, is the notion of having an all-you-can-eat breakfast.
Yeah.
Taking a five-minute break, and then having an all-you-can-eat
that's
lunch.
That's right.
Then another five-minute break,
right.
and all-you-can-eat dinner with drinks. I don't
yeah.
know if you know.
You have to bring your Purell to make sure you don't get any diseases
exactly.
while you're on the boat.
I will tell a story very quickly before we get to the calls. Mm-hmm. A former coworker of ours, I don't know if he wants us to use his name, so I won't, who a former coworker of ours is now at another station, wonderful guy. He and his wife did cruises. Almost, that's their sole form of entertainment, travel. They loved him.
Yes.
They get great deals. He went
cheap,
on one
cheap.
7-day cruise. He gained 17 pounds in 7 days. So
well,
can you imagine what it's like being on one of
yeah,
these things for a year?
Look at the picture of the dining room. Doesn't that look nice?
It's actually, well, no, it's not nice because they're big tables, which means you have to sit with people well, you don't not, know.
They have different size tables, Jim, depending on the size of your party. And I suppose
what if they seat you, let's say, what if they seat you with somebody who has a MAGA hat on? How are you going to feel about that being stuck at sea?
You slip the maitre d' $20 and you say, I need a different table.
Okay,
that's what
fine.
You do.
Let's go to Joe in Fall River, hometown of Marjorie again. What's
Hi,
up, Joe?
Joe?
Oh, hey, guys.
Hi.
I just came off a Norwegian a week ago.
There you go.
How was
and
it?
It was sensational. I've been on a couple of the other cruise lines, but I found Norwegian to be a more of a freestyle environment where you could choose your seating. There were multiple restaurants. Some of them are spectacular.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, Capital Grille, Ruth's Chris caliber.
Really?
And the service is impeccable. That's one of the things that really sells you is like, they can't do enough for
yeah.
you on these ships. They won't accommodate any need, any dietary need you have, everything else. And, you know, tell you, for it all, inclusive, for $2,500, I'm in.
Well, Joe, isn't the ratio of staff to guests something really like 3-1 or 4-1 or so? I mean, it's some really low ratio. So you get treated like, you know, King Tut, right?
It is. It is. And to your point, Marjorie, you know, when you, you know, slip some one of the staffs that you you know, get comfortable with, get friendly with, they really will go above and beyond
yeah.
to accomplish.
Joe, let me That's tell you something. I've known Marjorie Egan for 25 years. She's never slipped anybody anything.
Yes, That's, I have.
No, you have not.
You
when
have.
Did
Joe,
you,
Joe,
when did you slip
Joe
and make
attest,
your day a tip?
Joe will attest.
Thank
that
you,
on these cruise ships, you're supposed to give big, huge tips to all the people.
I didn't say you weren't supposed
to. When you
to.
Leave. Well, of course, I gave them the big, huge tips.
You did?
Yes.
No, you walked over to one of these people, slipping tips and said, can you get me a little better table? So
I've not done that.
I know that. Margaret.
I've not done that. But just yesterday, I slipped a little $20 bill to the housekeeper.
You did not?
Yes, I did.
Why?
Because she's doing a really good job.
Well, that was really
I liked
nice.
Her. And you know what? Well, anyway, I won't go into it.
I wish 877,
you would. No, I'm not. 877-301-8970 is the number. Would you consider, I mean, it's really a budgeting idea when you think about the cost of living around here, going on a cruise ship for $30,000 a year, no expense excluded.
Here's
or,
the
or no expense.
Every
all
expense,
expense
is included.
Included
Thank
put
you.
It that way. Except for you can't drink at breakfast and lunch
okay.
for free.
You can.
You can
just
drink
not for, free.
For dinner.
Okay,
for free.
With the drinks already. Paul from Worcester says, all you can eat for a year? So it's a whale watch. And all you need to see one is a mirror. I hope the aisles are double wide. Rachel in Rhode Island writes, absolutely, I would live on a cruise for $30,000 once my kids are in college. It's pretty, I mean, Jim from Rockport raises another concern of mine. Does that all-inclusive price on a cruise include Legionnaire's disease? And it is, It is true.
Well, wait a minute. I thought it was norovirus.
It was norovirus.
Isn't it Legionnaire's disease? They got in some convention down in Philadelphia or something like that. Yeah. That was your...
This guy said free norovirus, too. He beat you to the punch. Chris and Canton.
Okay, where are we going? Let's go to Skyla in Hull. Thank you for calling.
What's up?
Hey, you guys. It's funny and everything, except I just can't believe anyone could even take such an idea halfway seriously.
Why?
When cruising is just so environmentally unfriendly.
Well, that's a fairly good point.
Is it because of all the gas?
Bad for the planet. It's like you're floating around in a giant porta potty that's dumping into the ocean.
Giant porta potty.
It's so weird.
It's beautifully
there's
put.
Oh, you know.
Pollution.
Yeah.
You know, there's noise pollution that affects, we know it affects the right whales really badly.
Yeah.
It affects all sea life. So I just like, I can't even.
Well, can I tell you something, Skyla? I totally agree with you. Marjorie is a real problem.
Yeah.
The fact that she even brought this up is appalling to me.
Skyla, I have to admit, I didn't think of the floating porta potty angle, but you do have a very good point. You mean they don't stop in ports of call and have their own sewage system or something on the side of the boat? Yeah. No.
Well, let's not get into colonial.
Whatever it is, we know what you're talking about.
All right.
Let's not. Skyla, thanks. You know, we consider ourselves chastened. As part of Skyla's point, according to Reuters, this is ridiculous. A large cruise ship can have a carbon footprint greater than 12,000 cars.
Really?
Yeah. So, okay. Let's can we get Vincent Pastore back on the phone?
I did not.
Maybe not.
You know, I should have thought of that,
yeah,
I guess.
No,
should have thought of that.
We're talking about this as a theoretical kind of thing.
I thought it was the planes that were really bad. I didn't know it was the cruise ships that are really bad, too.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, they're rather large.
Yeah. Oh, my God. We're getting a lot of these environmental things. Why didn't we know that, Jim?
Well, I wish they had told us. What are our producers for? To protect us. They didn't do crap.
Marianne, in the car, what do you think?
Everyone is talking about environmental disasters, like every single text.
Okay.
It's horrible.
What she's talking about, I think the next person is talking about the tips for the staff. Is that what you're calling about, Marianne?
Yeah, what are you calling about, Marianne?
Paying the tips.
Hi. Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
Nice to hear you, Jim and Marjorie.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me on the show. I just went on a cruise on Norwegian in January.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the cruise lines don't really tell you too much up front when they're selling you that.
What is it?
Is the built-in gratuity.
Yeah.
20%. And for a 12-night cruise, that's hundreds of dollars. Can you imagine multiplying that for a whole year?
That's another good point.
Yeah.
So when they tell you, it's $2,500, it's really not. It's quite a bit more. And then if you go to specialty dining, like I did, if you did more than the time that they allow you for a package, you're paying like $60-$70 a night.
Wait a second.
What's that?
More time to eat or more time to stay on the ship? Which is it?
As far as...
Specialty dining. What does specialty dining mean?
Oh, specialty dining is like a Norwegian. It's their fancier dining that they offer.
Oh, I don't like that
at
all.
Like you can go to a seafood restaurant or I went to a hibachi grill kind of Japanese restaurant.
So what does that mean? For the $2,500, you get like chicken croquette or what do you get? I mean, is that
you probably get something like we had a garden cafe where it's sort of, you know, basic American kind of food that's cafeteria style. And it's perfectly fine food. But if you want like some of the fancier French cuisine or something like that, then you're paying an extra fee.
I don't like that at all, actually. Marianne, you really opened our eyes. I didn't know that.
Right. And then the drinks package they tell you for 12 nights is over $500. Multiply that by a year. They did say that alcohol is included. I wonder if there's a little... caveat.
Have you been waiting like years to get this out of your system or what?
No.
Marianne, you were fabulous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
That's a problem.
Apparently, Reuters reports that the industry promises to make zero emission vessels and fuels widespread by 2030, zero carbon cruising by 2050, but that still does not address...
And the cigarette companies say cigarette smoking is good for your health.
That still does not address the porta-potty issue, the floating porta-potty issue, I don't think.
That sort of destroyed the whole concept, don't you think?
Yeah.
The floating porta-potties kind of
ruined the whole idea for me. I'm sorry I went on the cruise.
And think about it, all those people... Was that a photograph of the actual ship you put up? The ship was huge.
Huge.
So we started totally into the idea, and the longer the conversation goes, we're less into the idea.
Well, you know, listen, if you can't afford an apartment in Boston, which so many people can't.
You live on one of these
this
things.
This is an alternative. Okay. It
is cheaper than living.
You got a porta potty problem.
Yeah.
But you're saving some money, and you're not totally broke and worried about your next meal.
And also, I have to say to the callers in Texas, you can't worry about destroying the planet on everything, can you? Just 12,000 cars is the equivalent.
Well, Jim has a Tesla. Blah, blah, blah.
Okay, fine, Margaret. it's not necessary to say that every day.
Way more affordable than 3 years at university, says Betsy in Princeton.
Good point, too.
Sounds like a great deal to me. Oh, God, we're getting it. Cruises are a slow death, says Bill from Templeton.
You know, listen to this, by the way. CNN just posted that people from Indiana and Delaware are the best tippers. What is that about?
I have no idea.
Really?
No, I don't know.
Okay, fine. We only have a minute left. And Al on the road, you get that minute. Go.
Hey, guys. That sounds like a prison sentence to me.
Well, there's a piece of that. It does, yeah.
Okay.
Keep going.
Why?
You couldn't pay me to do that. What if you get stuck in a rainstorm and you're stuck in that little room for 3 days?
Boy, that's a good point.
I mean,
just go eat for 3 days.
How many times can you see the same show?
Well, you have to go to the business lounge if it's raining. That's what you have to do. You have to go to the indoor restaurant.
And you can copy some documents, Al. Yeah. That's where you can spend your time when it's raining.
What are you doing? Right.
Exactly.
Oh, no. I'm not a cruise person. I wouldn't last 3 years. I'd be jumping off the damn ship.
So the floating porta potty didn't make it more appealing to you?
Not at all.
Okay, we tried.
Okay.
Al, that's enough. Thank you very much for your call.
Well,
we
shame on us. It's your fault we didn't have the
porta
potty angle
fault.
Before this started.
They're going to be one less producer on the show tomorrow.
Research.
Let me tell you right now.
Okay. All right, we are done.
Isn't that their job to protect us from damaging topics?
Too late now,
Jesus.
Jim. Okay.
Jamie, you were great. Really, yep. You were. You really
keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. On Monday, we're going to be joined by Michael Curry from the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, our food policy man, Corby Kummer, Evan Horowitz from the Tufts Center of State Policy Analyst. He is a genius when it comes to tax policy, and he's going to explain all about the new budget proposal made by
from
Mayor
Moore
Healey. The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emma G. Price III will be with us, and Boston Globe travel writer, I love him, yeah. Christopher Muther. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Hannah Loss, Nicole Garcia, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, with Brian Bell on the boards. This is Brian Bell's last day, and I want to thank him for
fabulous.
His brilliant, brilliant work. We're going to really miss you. You've been great to be here for us. And
Well, I got to tell the truth, though.
What?
Until he got you tickets to an event, you weren't talking so highly
of him. That's right.
I
didn't like him, but then he said, get me tickets.
No, we worked with him years ago at the old place. He is spectacular, and we hope he's here a lot in the future.
Yep.
Brian, thanks for everything. Really
our executive producer, Jane Bologna, is going to explain himself right after the show.
Well, you know what also occurred to me? We didn't tell people. We only have a minute left. We didn't tell people. We actually sort of went on a cruise together. Do you remember? At
yes,
our old station.
A tall ship.
We went on a Russian tall ship.
God.
We slept in bunk
beds.
It was
a nightmare.
With four listeners in the same room.
About 12 people.
And when I stood up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, I didn't realize that I was going to walk into one of those fly strips with like 100 flies
on. They were everywhere.
Right smack on my face.
There was a fly infestation in the bunk room.
Now that was a good time.
Anyway, thank you very much to the BPL team, Evelyn Brito, Colin Cockrell, Sai Patel, and thank you again to Brian Bell.
Yeah, thank you, Brian.
Got a big deal here tomorrow at the Boston Public Library, special Work It Out Wombats event. The Newsfeed Cafe and GBH are welcoming families to a screening of the show, two episodes, and an appearance by Zeke, the youngest wombat, for a meet and greet with kids and their families, plus wombat cookies and coloring activities. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning. See
Thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great weekend.
Bye.
See you Monday.